unable to deliver the annual report. The procedure, as I understand it, is frank here, is that the minister writes to the speaker. I think I sent you guys a note, the committee members, about this. And that the speaker then, I think the minister CC'd to the committee chair. And of course, in our committee, we distribute it to the members. And we don't have a say on these issues, so we've raised this before. But apparently, in the terms of the PFMA, the speaker is not required, what I understand, to let us know. So it is that, and in fact, the Auditor General will have something to say. So what we're going to do then is, what we have, if you look at your draft program, which we'll look at tomorrow, postpone the annual report consideration by our committee to the 28th. But we have to submit our BRRR report before the MTBPS. So, of course, we look only at National Treasury now. And secondly, we had thought that we would look at the legal opinion by the the response of the minister on the extension of the term of office of the SAA board chair today, but we should put that as the last item on the agenda, really. We have got Frank's reply, and then we have to process it further. We've also got something that I just saw now at about 10 to 2. It came from Mr. Lees via Allen about the use of a certain section of the PFMA to give the money that has been given last week to SAA, and whether it's legal or not. Now, that's a legal matter. I would suggest we don't discuss it today. But if the DM, welcome DM and the team, of course, both from your side, National Treasury, DG is here, of course, and the AG's office, to say, look, if you want to say anything, DM, on that, but I think let's defer it because it's a legal matter. So if that's okay, can we get going? Fine. Agreed. Good. Over to you, AG's office, sorry.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good afternoon, Honorable Members. My name is Solisa Hoa. I'm a corporate executive in the Office of the Auditor General. Perhaps before we go into the presentation, if I can just introduce my team. To the left, I've got Mr. Tamizi Gode, who is the business executive responsible for this portfolio. And then I've got Naresha Punsami, who is the SM, or the senior manager, who was responsible for the audit. The purpose of this presentation is really to share with yourselves the audit outcomes of the finance portfolio for the 2016-17 to enable you with your oversight role and hopefully also contribute to the budget review and recommendations that you make. Without any further ado, I'm going to hand over to my SM, who will then take us through the presentation, and then afterwards we can take questions. Thank you. Over to you.
Good afternoon.
Shall I suggest between 20 and 25 minutes, is that okay? And focus on also particularly what you think the committee should focus on. That's very interesting to us. And obviously, as for your role and so on, we all know that, right? So you can skip those slides. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Chair. So we're going to skip the first few slides, and I will start on slide number 11. Is that okay? Yeah. Okay. The audit outcomes of the portfolio, as we can see in the 2016-17 year, we have 14 auditees that's in the finance portfolio, of which five of the auditees achieved a clean audit. Seven, which is 50%, achieved unqualified with findings on other matters. And then we have two delayed audits, SAF and SAA. If we move on to slide number 12, slide number 12. And
I'm sorry, she's too fast for me.
A bit slow down.
Okay.
A bit.
Okay. If we move to slide number 12, Slide number 12 speaks to the management and delivery on key programs. And on slide 12, we look at GEPA. Now, GEPA and National Treasury received the most significant budget allocation in terms of the portfolio. So we focused on the performance information for these two audits. On GEPA, the two programs that we audited were Support Services and Benefits Administration. The budget spent 76% on support services. We did identify material misstatements. We did not identify any unauthorized on support services. We had no findings supported in the audit report, and all targets were achieved. Under Benefits Administration, 78% of the budget was spent. We did identify material misstatements, which GEPA corrected. There was no unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. There were no findings that impacted the audit report, and 89% of the targets were achieved. If we move to slide 13, I now present the National Treasury programs that we audited. We audited four programs: Program 2, Economic Policy, Tax, Financial Regulation, and Research. The budget spent was 97%. We did identify material misstatements on reliability. There was no unauthorized, irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. No material findings that impacted the audit report. And 100% of the targets were achieved. Program 4, Asset and Liability Management, we spent 97% of the budget. Material misstatements were identified, which were corrected. No unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. No findings that impacted the audit report. 90% of the targets were achieved. Program 7, Civil and Military Pensions, Contributions to Funds and Other Benefits. The budget spent was 99%, no material findings, no unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, no findings that impacted the audit report, and 100% of the targets were achieved. Program 8, Technical and Management Support and Development Finance. Budget spent 96%, again, no material misstatements, no unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, no findings on the audit report, and 96% of the targets were achieved. If we go to slide number 14, speaks to the financial health of the auditees that we audited. As can be highlighted in the slide, there were no material uncertainty that exists whether the auditees can continue to operate in the future, meaning that none of these auditees have any going concern issues. Slide number 15. Here we look at the movement on the quality of the financial statements, the annual performance reports, and compliance. So on the audit, on the financial statements, in the blue box, we had 13 audits that submitted their financial statements on time. SAA is the only auditee that has not yet submitted its financial statements. In the yellow blocks, we have 8 auditees, that's 67%. That had no material misstatements on the financial information. If we move to the middle blocks on the findings on annual performance report, we had 7 auditees that had no findings or no material misstatements on the annual performance report. We have in the blue in the pink blocks, we have 2 audits that had material findings on the performance information. If we move to the last columns, there we highlight the compliance with key legislation, 5 of our auditees had no findings on compliance information, while 7 had issues on compliance, whether it was material misstatements on the financial statements, annual performance report, or non-compliance with SCM. If we move on to slide number 16, here we speak to the unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure over the last 3 years. None of our auditees had unauthorized expenditure. Fruitless and wasteful, in the 2016-17 year, there was 70 million rand worth of fruitless and wasteful that increased. And for irregular expenditure, in the 2016-17 year, we had 140 million rand worth of irregular expenditure. So that also increased. Slide number 17 speaks to common findings within SCM. And what we have picked up is within the portfolio, we had issues on 3 quotations not being invited, competitive bidding not invited, preference point system not applied or incorrectly applied, and then we had one instance of the supplier's tax affairs not in order. Slide number 18 speaks to fraud and consequence management. Within the portfolio, we had one auditee that had findings on non-compliance with legislation, and this was reported under consequence management. Allegations of financial and fraud and SCM misconduct, we had none. And if we look at the on the right, we look at the green blocks. We had 3 auditees that investigated all of the 15-16 irregular expenditure in the 16-17 financial year. Slide number 19 speaks to SCM findings reported to management for investigation. And as highlighted in the previous slide, all the auditees that had irregular expenditure from the previous year, they were all investigated during the 2016-17 financial year. If we move on to slide number 20, the status of the internal controls. Under leadership, we have 64% of our auditees that are doing quite well on the leadership side. On the financial and performance management, that has reduced to 37%. So there needs to be more focus around the financial and performance management side. And then on the governance, we have seen that all our auditees, governance committees, which is your audit and your risk committees, your internal audits, and your audit committees are quite strong, and they're functioning quite efficiently. On slide number 21, these are the assurance levels at the various levels. First level speaks to senior management, the accounting officer, accounting authority, and the executive authority. The second level speaks to our governance committees, the internal audit and audit committee, and the third level to our standing committee. On this slide, you will notice that there's only 11 auditees. One of our auditees we have classified as a small auditee, and it's not included in the assessment at assurance level. Slide number 22 speaks to the root causes, and we found that 7 of our auditees, the root cause was a slow response to improving key controls and addressing key risk areas. And we had one auditee where there was inadequate consequences for poor performance and transgression. In terms of instability or vacancies in key positions, we had no auditees that had this as a root cause. Slide number 23, on the commitments and proposed recommendations. For the 17-18 financial year, the key commitments that we want the portfolio to focus on, the first one being the Twin Peaks model, And we know that this model, the Twin Peaks, has now been legislated. However, now the monitoring of the coordination and implementation of the Twin Peaks needs to be looked at so that we don't have regression in audit outcomes. We actually have four auditees within the finance portfolio that might be that will be impacted by the Twin Peaks. The second commitment that's also in working progress is the IFMS project. And the third commitment, which is a new commitment, speaks to procurement reforms that needs to be implemented. And then on the right-hand side, the column, we would like the portfolio committee to engage with the department on those four areas. Slide number 24 speaks to the areas we would like the committee to consider in its process. The first one speaking to performance reporting, reasons for non-achievement of targets, what was the program spending used for if targets not achieved. In the financial statements, we're looking at contract management, mainly the extensions and variations in contracts resulting in evergreen contracts. Consequence management for staff that permit the incurrence of irregular and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, and the recovery mechanisms. IT contracts, and this is specifically related to where auditees are developing its own in-house systems. Procurement, ensuring full compliance with the applicable legislation, and that is coming through from all the findings on the compliance side. Especially on the SEM, and then a detailed approved project plan with set milestones and due dates for IFMS, accompanied by an approved yearly budget for each significant deliverable. If we move on to slide 25, we just give a very brief overview of the audits that are still outstanding at 31 August. The SAS audit is not yet finalized owing to matters still under dispute and consultations, and then also the SAA audit. Slide number 26 speaks to our enhanced audit methodology that we implemented now in the 16-17 financial year, and the audits will be more focused on and integrated with a robust risk approach, allowing us to continue driving accountability and good governance. So we now have an integrated audit approach. Slide number 27 speaks to the key control engagements and the objectives that we want to achieve with the key control engagements. We want to identify areas of concern as early as possible, so our quarterly engagements with the auditee will assist us in identifying areas of concern and if there will be any possible regression in audit outcomes, so we can start addressing our risk as early as possible. We will be providing our assessment of the status of key focus areas that we have reviewed. We will discuss this with management within the audit team. We will also assess progress made in implementing the action plan. So we'll be able to identify as early as possible if the action plan is being implemented and risk areas identified through the audit process is being followed up on. And then hopefully through this whole process, we can also add value to the audit team. And that's the end of my presentation.
Take some questions, comments, please, from members. Mr. Lees.
Thank you. Sorry, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the AG team for the presentation. I'm pleased to see that in fact you guys are doing the audit on SAA, so disturbing that it's not complete yet though, but there you go. In terms of those two outstanding issues, What are the issues? I mean, you're saying it's in terms of SAS, the going concern status. Why is that delaying your report? If an entity is not a going concern, and it's never going to be a going concern, perhaps, let's assume, why would you never then issue an audit report? So why the delay, if that is the only reason for the delay? And then what are the reasons for the SARS delay?
I've asked your questions for you, Mr. Lee. No, that's what, it's so boring. That's the point. So boring. Remember, as a chair, I have to listen to every word you'll say. Whereas you guys can drift into your cell phones, and it's very boring. But you know what? It's correct. You should raise those questions. You're a member of the DA. Okay, fine. Nothing stops. No. I realize immediately I said it, what you might understand me to mean, but I didn't mean that. I withdraw that. Thank you.
Chair, thanks. First, I want to thank National Treasury for considering our request, which I made in 302, that other boardroom when I made a request that SAA must be audited by the AG. So I want to congratulate them for finally adhering to that, because it's not just a cost-saving mechanism, but we can actually trust that audit not to be questionable, I think, is the Auditor General. I have this trust for the Auditor General. For some reason, when I was in scope, I would prefer an audit that came from the AG as compared to a private institution. Because the AG doesn't draw some benefits that other companies draw when they audit. So there's some element of national interest in it. So that's the first achievement. But secondly, I'm worried that the AG is not speaking to the... And I know, DG, you are very tired. You have been engaging on this matter for some time, and being new to hear this might not be so inspiring to you. I'm worried about the integrated financial management system. And I thought we'll be taking into confidence the fact that this was presented in Scopa for it to come to us. Because any financial management tool, its piloting starts with National Treasury before it can be implemented by any government department. So if challenges happens at this level, then one gets a little bit worried. So I don't want members of SCOF to catch it in the grapevine. I want it to, in a way, maybe the AG will not speak to it, but just note DG to a brief. But it could have been nice if when they speak to it, they relate whether it was part of fruitless or irregular expenses, so that we clear the air, that people get to understand exactly what happened. And secondly, if GIPA doesn't achieve 100% in relation to its targets when it deals with benefits, it might not be a big sum, but it might raise a red flag. Maybe we should, in a way, get to understand. It's not a big amount, it's not 10%, but you see, but this is Jeep, it's on benefits, so it's a different issue altogether. And if it's 140 million irregular expenditure in one program, to me it's big. I'll make this anecdote. Many years ago when I arrived here, a specific president announced the extended public works program to be undertook by the Department of Public Works then. And that department at that time had an irregular expenditure that was equal to what it was supposed to invest in the EPWP program. I put my head literally under the desk when that announcement was made. And you see, yeah, it's not any other department, it's your model department. 140 in terms of the PFMA, it might not look like a big chunk of money, DG, but it sets a precedent. It sets a precedent that you can have 100 million irregular. At least it's not unauthorized, but it's irregular. And tomorrow it will be the Department of Sanitation saying we've got 1 billion irregular expenditure or unauthorized expenditure, and the precedents will have been set if it's not kept. So basically, I want us to come to that. But when it comes to SAA, and I'm saying this in a very regrettable way, that it has been a tendency from SAA not to submit its annual statements on time. And I know you might want to say it relates to its status on the going concern. It will be coupled to that, DG. Maybe they can say, well, we're waiting for guarantees for us to know whether we are still a going concern or we not. But to me, it's also management issues. And I'm interested to know what the AG, they might have not shared with us the management letters that they sent to UDG and that they sent to SAA. But it will be interesting to give us an idea, the type of management letters they've sent, because those resolutions can also be followed by us, DM, in an event that implementation has not been realized, to help to ensure, because very soon we'll be going to the quarterly report of SAA. So the management letters are a recommendation of some sort to us to be able to understand. With us, you did not say much about what disputes. My experience with disputes, Chair, is that there's a tendency with government departments to dispute the audit outcomes of the AG when actually it's based on materiality, things that has actually been tested. Because you see, when the AG do an audit, they take information based on what you say you will achieve or whatsoever and test it. And based on that, they say, but you did not comply. So it can't be a dispute. So in this context, I want to understand, what do they mean by dispute? Because you can't dispute an audit outcome that has been based on material outcomes of what has been before the AG. It should be something else. So if it was about performance measurement, because remember we said the AG should move from only doing financial auditing but doing performance auditing. So if disputes are about targets, please brief us so that we know, was it relating to the targets that SAS said will achieve, or it was other material outcomes that related to what you tested before you. Thanks, Chair. I don't want to delay the meeting.
You don't want to speak for too long? Okay. Okay, yeah. All right, very good point there. Who's next? Mr. Lees, you had a bite. We'll come back to you. It's Floyd, and then Mr. Lees, and then Gloria.
Not two quick issues, Chair. I wanted to understand from the AG's view on what is the nature of dispute with SARS, like, in terms of the audited financial statement. And two, I wanted the AG to express an opinion on the National Treasury's usage of the emergency fund in terms of Section 16 on SAA. I think because isn't that money in South Africa must be expended through law. It's not like a personal account or where people can just use it as and when they wish. So they must be a legal basis for money to be expended for any function in South Africa. I thought that is the principles that are established in the constitution and in the legislation that govern the uses of money. So I hope the AG won't tiptoe around it. Those are two issues, Chair.
The committee agreed as a whole that that matter, it comes from a letter, well, I don't know why Mr. Shivamba's raising it, maybe it's another, but the letter that comes from Mr. Lees, we've agreed on a process. And we're going to refer it to lawyers and so on and come back to the department. As for whether you should or shouldn't answer that question, we didn't discuss it. If you feel you want to answer it, it's fine, but you don't have to. Because you have to look at the...
This is not how committee meetings are.
No, that's your view. We met here.
We're out of order.
No, you were not here at 2 o'clock. We took a decision.
No,
now, I'm ruling.
That is not how I am ruling. I'm asking the AG a question.
Yes,
you can't really tell the question for any whatever reason.
Fine.
I don't work for the ANC. I'm not an ANC member.
I'm not deployed by the ANC. No,
you can ask whatever question I want to ask.
No. Right. Now, let me put it to you. I'm the chair. The committee took a decision. The decision was that as far as the letter that deals with the same matter is concerned, it will be dealt with in the way we agreed. Now, the AG's office is being asked the question. That's a separate matter from what we discussed. If you have seen the letter, perhaps you want to reply in writing. We will forward the letter to you. You can give your tentative response for now. You are not obliged, I'm ruling, to give a fully fledged answer to that question. You don't know what the issues are. They run you 3 pages, is that right? So I'm ruling, and if people don't like it, they must leave. That's it.
Listen, this is not a personal committee. You must respect us here.
It's not your structure either.
You must respect us.
You must
us
respect
here.
Me as the chair. Right? And the collective decision of this committee.
You must respect us and you must be consistent. You go and march against that capture and come and defend nonsense here.
No, that's not the issue.
You must be consistent.
Now, the committee,
you must be consistent.
Can that committee decide now whether you want to review the decision? The letter has just come to us right now.
Well, understand the letter. I'm asking a simple question.
Fine.
Why do you have to sanitize it? Why can't you allow the AG to speak for itself?
Yes, but we have already discussed the matter. I'm now ruling that you answer the way, within the framework I've given, you're not obliged to answer that question. Right.
But you must be consistent. You must be a straightforward person and do not be all over in terms of what you're supposed to be doing with you.
Fine. Right. Now, on that matter of rules, can we move on? Who's got a question? You have.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to break your boredom by asking something that you might not have predicted, but I think you'll probably find it is predictable. In terms of the, the chart on 11 gives you the unqualified audits with matters and so on. There's been one entity that's, other than the two that you haven't audited, one entity, and that's the FFC, which has moved from so-called clean to with matters. And I wonder if you could give us some idea of what those matters were. And then just in terms of the unauthorized and irregular and so on, there wasn't any unauthorized, but fruitless and irregular expenditure on slide 16. That's a combined figure for all the entities, is it, that you audited? So is there no single entity where there was, if you look at the whatever number there was that you audited, 11, 140, that's 1.4 million, 1.3 million each or something like that. Was there no big amount in a single entity? How does that break down, basically? Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Not expressing myself very well this afternoon.
Gloria, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. On slide 22, one of the root causes stated is a slow response by management. I'd like to know how the Auditor General has engaged with audit committees and other governance structures to intervene with that root cause. And then on slide 25, with regards to non-submission of financial statements, I'd like to know if the Auditor General does not have a cut-off date for submission of financial statements. And in addition to that, how is it acceptable the delay on submission of financial statements just on the basis of a going concern assumption? My understanding is that although the auditee would use or not use the going concern assumption, it would still remain the responsibility of the auditor to go and make its own evaluation of the assumption, and that should not necessarily be a cause for delay of the audit. Thank you.
A quick few quick questions. Firstly, I'm looking at slide 24, which I think is very helpful. Firstly, can I? Oh, you want to say something? Yes.
There's one point I forgot. I'm not sure whether is it going to be responded to by the AG's office or by National Treasury, but it's in the on the actual annual report, page 225, under fruitless expenditure. And I want to read it out. It says, as disclosed in note 27 to the financial statements, fruitless and wasteful expenditure to the amount of 69.6 million was incurred as the department made payments for which no services has been received. So I want us...
Just add about why you say that.
No. I'll come back to...
What I'm getting a bit worried about, you must give direction now. We really have to focus on the department with some sense of what the Auditor General's office is saying. And really it's for us to use this as a guide. But we can deal with that both now and later.
Can I finish my point?
You see,
this disclosure is only made in the actual annual report, but I thought it was going to be captured in the slides that there's this specific amount which was paid when services were not, so that as part of this fruitless, it's lifted out, but it was not reflected. So in a way, maybe there's a reason why the AG's office excluded it as an important thing to highlight. To me, even if it was 1 million, if payment was made for a service is not rendered, it amounts to fraud or corruption, you know. So that's why I'm putting it to both to speak to it.
Firstly, looking at slide 24, right, the department's being alerted to this, right? We've raised these issues with you before. What you spend the money, but you don't achieve the targets. You've discussed that. They have replied last year, but we don't want the same reply as last year. National Treasury, can you take it forward, right? If DG, you remember. On the matter of contract management, right, this thing about evergreen contracts, could you just add a bit AG's office, and could you reply National Treasury? Now, this one the committee feels very strongly about, right? Not only us, Parliament as a whole, and the ANC, and I'm sure other political parties too, that people commit irregularities and nothing happens to them. So maybe the AG's office will add a bit here, but we'd like National Treasury to reply to that, presumably. On the IT contracts, now, this integrated financial management system. Now, firstly, you know, there's accusations of corruption, and there's counter-accusations that, you know, this is part of a political plot to contain National Treasury and so on. So at this stage, it's being dealt with by SCOPA and the Appropriations Committee. But what I think we need to do here is also ask, in your work as the Auditor General's office, did you pick up anything about corruption? If not, why not? I know you're going to say that you deal with transactions and not, but, you know, it is very, very odd to parliamentarians, I think, let alone the public out there, that you give departments a clean audit and then 18 or 24 months later we discover there's wholesale corruption there, and then the corruption is actually proven in the public domain. Sometimes there are even prosecutions, you know, but yet the Auditor General's office never picks that up. Now, I think you're going to reply as you normally do, that you're not attuned to do that, but that's something that you can't shrug away from. maybe you need to look at your methodology and so on. So how is it that happens? But in particular, in this case, because it's in the public domain, though it's being dealt with by two other committees, what happened about the integrated financial management systems? Then the rest of it, I think each of these questions, please, DG, if you'd reply to them. Then I also want to draw attention to elsewhere, the slide before that. What exactly are you saying on the Twin Peaks model issue? How will it change things? If you can explain a bit. Then you do refer to the IFMS project there. On procurement reform, can you add a bit so we're clear, and then the department will have to reply to some of these issues. Thank you. Floyd?
I hope you heard what we were doing earlier. Then you must listen. What informs the AG's decision to keep the services of KPMG when there's prima facie misconduct and wrongdoing on their part? I think that we need some explanation as well. How do you associate with KPMG, even when there's clear evidence that they're violating the basis of auditing?
Good. Over to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Chair, I'll start with the issue of the South African Airways. I think as mentioned there, the South African Airways hasn't given any copy of financial statements to the Auditor General for audit, so we don't have anything to audit. Therefore, we cannot finalize an audit when we don't have anything to audit. So it's a very simple issue on that one. Then I'll move to the issue of the South African Revenue Services. I think the issue is, as part of the audit process, you would normally raise a finding, and once the client has appreciated that this is a valid issue that you're raising, then they can say how they then going to respond in terms of making sure that proper controls are put in place so that the finding that has been raised does not occur going further. Therefore, the issue here, we are not at that stage yet. They still have the belief that they are correct on the issue, and we still have the belief that they are not correct on the issue. Those engagements need to carry on up until we finalize the audit. However, we are at a very advanced stage. We're going to be finalizing the issue very soon, and the issue revolves around one section, which is Section 83 of the SAR, 18 of the SAR Act, and I won't give any further details to that, Chair. But I think later on when SARs present, they can talk to that issue. Then come to the issue of the disputes. For me, yes, we're using the term disputes, which is, I think this was just a general question. The issue is, when you raise a finding, when the client defend their stance, for me, that is not necessarily a dispute, but it's a difference of opinion, because they think what they've done is correct, and therefore they would try and justify that what you've done is actually correct under the circumstances. So it's a matter of getting to a point where, when looking at the very same set of circumstances, where do we then, what's the point at which we get to see different set of results? And that is where we need to nip this thing and deal with it and close it. So the dispute, whenever you are involved in an audit process, everybody that has been audited before will tell you, you will never close a matter on audit up until you've reached an agreement. And all the audits, even the clean ones, you find that the audit is clean, but however, somewhere along the line, there was an instance where there was a dispute, there was no seeing eye to eye with the client. And up until the point where there is an agreement on all those issues, then the audit is closed off properly. Then there was an issue of how do we engage on the audit committee on the issues. I'll hand over to my colleagues on the other issues, but I'm just responding to the questions, which I think it's purely easier questions for me, I think. The audit committees are well informed of all the issues that are happening within the audits. In addition to that, we had a lot of engagements on a quarterly basis with the accounting officers, with the CEOs and the CFOs, mainly with the view of making sure that by the time we audit, we don't struggle in resolving some of the issues. Some of the issues that we normally deal with is issues of technical nature. Some of the issues are issues of a legal nature. like what has been said now. So you find that when you raise an issue, instead of necessarily talking to the issue from a simplistic point of view, then somebody throws onto the table a legal opinion. Then that changes the whole debate and the discussion, because now we need to sort of change from being a simplistic person, but now start arguing the legal basis of the matter. So that's what complicates the issues. However, the audit committees are fully informed of the issues. We've spoken to the audit committees about the stagnant audit outcomes. We've spoken to them in terms of what is it that needs to be looked at for the audit outcomes to improve. Now, on the issue of don't we have a submission deadline for financial statements, I think that's not our submission deadline. The PFMA specifically states that on this particular date, a set of financial statements will be submitted to the Auditor General for audit purposes, and it lists what needs to be submitted on the 31st of May. That is the date that is prescribed in the PFMA. Then on the issue of going ahead and evaluating going concern when you don't have financial statements, from my understanding of auditing, that's something that cannot be done, because management is the one that needs to assess their going concern way before they prepare the financial statements. By the time they prepare the financial statements, they need to know whether they're preparing them on a going concern basis or any other appropriate basis, and give that set to the auditors for audit purposes. Then as part of the audit process, you then assess whether that assessment is appropriate, at least according to your knowledge. Then what I was saying about the Twin Peaks model, Chair, I think the issue that we're trying to avoid at this stage is that looking at some of the documents we engaged on the Twin Peaks model is that the model, the FSB will cease to exist somewhere mid-July. And then from that date onwards, it becomes a new entity. So we're saying, from the perspective of the audit, it might be a bit tricky to audit the set of financial statements till 31st of March, and then you audit 3 months to July. Then later on, you audit another entity for 9 months of the period. So if those dates can coincide with the year end, it will make life slightly easier. And that's just a suggestion from us to say let's consider that. I think I've covered most of the questions. Sorry, is there anything you would want to add?
Maybe, Naresh, if you can just deal with the issues that relate to the slides, just to provide more context there.
Okay, thank you. One of the questions raised was on GPA not achieving its targets. If you look at the reason that is in the annual report, the client introduced new SLAs during the 16-17 year with more stringent targets and more stringent measures. And GPA and the client has agreed that to achieve 100%, they're going to take more than a year in order to achieve the 100%. So it was more around the SLA agreements and the measures that they put in place between GPA and the client on the SLA. So that's the non-achievement of targets there. In terms of the 140 million rand irregular, if we can go to that slide and I can give the breakdown. The question was, is there certain departments or is there one particular department that caused a majority of the irregular expenditure? There was 70 of the 140 million, 77.4 million was from GTAC, and this is as a result of the long-term advisors contracts that we found to be irregular in the 15-16 year. So those contracts still have another 3 years. It's 5 year contracts, and they still have another 3 years. So we will see irregular expenditure coming through for the next 3 years as well. 47.5 million was for National Treasury, of which 28 million relates to the procurement of the central supplier database. Treasury did not follow the FCM processes. 7 million was as a result of contract variation that was not properly approved by the relevant authority within Treasury, and 12.1 million was on a contract that was awarded on an incorrect BE certificate. The details of all of that is also in the annual report. And then last, GPA, that only had 7.3 million rand worth of irregular, and that was through normal SCM, non-compliance with SCM. So I hope I covered that. And then, Then in terms of FFC, yes, rightly pointed out that it actually regressed from a clean audit to unqualified with findings. They had findings on compliance matters, and those findings related to payments not being made within 30 days. And just one more. And UIF, sorry, irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure not being prevented. So there was two compliance matters that caused FFC to regress.
I mean, for the FFC to be in this situation is not acceptable, really. It's just not acceptable. So maybe in the next quarter, we look into wasteful. Can you note this? I don't know when we'll find the time, but we can try to bring them before us to actually look at their situation and why this is what it is.
Then I think the last question on my side in terms of the slides is on the fruitless and wasteful expenditure, the 69 million. So if I can explain that we found that there were two instances of fruitless and wasteful expenditure. National Treasury entered into the a contract with Oracle where they purchased the software licenses and technical support. The system is not yet implemented. It will be fully implemented in 2021-22. However, the National Treasury has started, in terms of the agreement, they have started paying for technical support. So of the 69 million, 66 million is, or 65 million rather, is as a result of technical support that they have paid for without receiving any services. Okay. In terms of slide 24, the evergreen contract, let me just get to that quickly. It comes back from contract management, and what we have identified is that there's a lot of contracts that are being extended or being varied, and they're becoming evergreen. And what should happen is there should have been a process to go out and look at the market and see whether these service providers are the sole service providers, or to just check the market to see if you can get these maintenance contracts, or I'm just giving an example, these contracts on which is more cost efficient. So basically what's happening within the portfolio is contracts are just being extended, and auditees are not going out to the market or not following SCM process to look to see if there are other service providers that can provide the same services.
Thank you, Naresh. If I can deal with the remaining questions. The question about the emergency funds, obviously we don't have details to be able to respond on that particular matter. If I can then go to the IFMS, the issue around whether we picked up any corruption whilst we were auditing, the answer is no. And why not? I think, Chair, you as you indicated, our methodology is not geared to be able to detect corruption. So that's primarily the reason why we were not able to identify any corruption.
Anywhere in the world, does the Auditor General's Office play a role in detecting corruption? You see, we have this number one in the world auditing standard. Mm-hmm. Only this morning we discover what's going on, and we've been seeing it for a year or two now. On this matter, it's just abominable. It's not your fault that you get a clean audit and then you discover there's wholesale corruption in a department. There's no AG's office anywhere in the world address that issue of corruption. Well, can't you detect it? I know you can't, but yeah. Can't an AG's office do so?
We can we've got relationships with other Supreme Audit Institution, Chair. We can engage to find out how corruption is dealt with and respond to that accordingly in writing.
Can you tell us where else in the world there is a role that provides for an AG office to actually detect corruption?
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. On the issue of KPMG, Chair, we obviously have taken a stance on this particular matter. We are following up on the investigations that have been carried out by IRPA, KPMG International, as well as SAICA. And until we've got clarity, by the way, we also continue to engage one-on-one with KPMG as well to understand some of the issues. And until we have received, or once we receive the feedback from that those investigations, we will be obviously be able to take the firm position or going forward. At the moment, we obviously have intensified the monitoring processes around KPMG and also just the reviews. For them in particular, we have put a mechanism to review them annually, whilst the rest of the other service providers, we review them on a two-yearly basis. I think that is it in terms of the outstanding questions. Yeah.
If KPMG is found guilty, it will be untenable, presumably, for the Auditor General's Office to retain their services. You don't have to comment. The AG might want to comment on that. I'm just saying I would take it the committee would feel that way and the public would feel that way. That's all I'm making. I'm not saying respond. Okay, thank you. But can we please move on to National Treasury? It's now almost 3 o'clock.
Chairperson, I think you must raise an issue about the issue. All right.
Chair, I'm still not sure whether I understand what the AG's office is saying in relation to the 47 million when it says it relates to procurement of data base supply. Because this note says the services were not received. So does it suggest that 47 million was paid upfront to supply a database and that was not supplied at all and National Treasury paid in advance? I'm left confused. I'm not sure when the AG was dealing with that, what are the specific outcomes? What did they find? Because payment has been made to the amount of 47 million. And she says it related to a procurement of data suppliers. And I'm left more confused as to how this payment was made, if at all there was no service at all. So maybe the DG at some point will explain further, but I wanted to... and when I used the words fraud, because to me, once a payment is made and there's no track of services that have been received, it might, maybe I used the wrong words, but it to say it's tantamount to fraud, but maybe it's, I don't know if I use the word irregular. To me, it still doesn't suffice to say you make a payment of 47 million and it's irregular. It's like you say, I'm going to build 20 houses, you don't build them and you are paid in advance and those houses are not there. So maybe it's wasteful, or I don't know, but maybe, I don't want to push it any further. Let's hear what.
Yeah, you see, can I suggest something, colleagues? Can we look at this process, the way we do this, right? I think ideally from next year onwards, wherever it's here, what we should do is each time the AG's office says something, we allow the Treasury to respond. Rather than now, you know, a whole series of things, and then people walk out of here with a particular perception, we might not hear Treasury's reply. Can we think about that? It's not for now. That each issue, let them speak, let the DG and Minister or Deputy Minister respond. But that's for next year. Mr. Lees and then Floyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in terms of this going concern thing, I absolutely agree. If you don't get given financial statements to audit, then you can't audit, whatever the reason is that the client is not giving them to you. But I really would like an answer to the question, because my question was a kind of hypothetical question rather than a specific question. So in the event that you do get a set of financial statements and they're not a going concern, you would audit and issue your report. Okay, the nodding. So it's only because you haven't received anything that you're unable to proceed, not because of the going concern. And just for clarity, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then In terms of dispute, whatever discussion, whatever you want to call it, are you saying that until there's agreement, and that's what I heard you saying, then you don't sign off on that audit? So, I mean, how long could that take? Is there no deadline at all from your point of view? I know there's a deadline from the client's point of view to present an annual report in Parliament and so on, but so would you just carry on talking, and then where would that end? And then, Mr. Chairman, AG is saying they're not going to talk, or this is what I heard, and maybe I got it wrong, but it's Section 18.3 of the SARS Act, and we're not going to hear anything more about that from you. Like, must we ask National Treasury about that? Or you seem to think we must ask SARS, actually. I think you remember you saying SARS. So, yeah. So, but we're not going to hear now.
SARS will have a right to say, too. So what we do is, with Alan, can you ensure that when SARS appears here, they are allowed to come in and give an input? Floyd?
Quick issues on follow-up is, what kind of details are you waiting for to express an opinion on the usage of the emergency fund? You said that you have not familiarized. What kind of because the information is there. The National Treasury issued a statement, and the Act is there. Like, I'm sure, or you're waiting for everything else to happen, and then you'll express an opinion next year. To observe illegal activity in procession, and then you say, no, we can't express anything now, we'll express it after a year. That is one. And then the two, what further information are you looking for from KPMG? Because they've admitted themselves of wrongdoing. I mean, and you are supposed to be an institution that is held in high regard in terms of overseeing the how public monies are utilized by entities, and all of us put our trust in you, and then you continue to associate with an institution that has publicly admitted to wrongdoing. So we must not trust you as well. And those are all the issues that you must have to. This is what requires wisdom now of the AG's office, of how do we continue to trust you if you are associating with KPMG. And the last issue is, what then becomes the implications of the delays of SAA in terms of submitting financial statements on the AGM? Because the the minister and deputy minister said here, and the DG say that SAA is going to go to its AGM on the 3rd of November. But the AG says that there's no financial statements submitted, they can audit them. What happens? Is the AGM going to be postponed? We'll ask them when they come now, that are going to extend to 2 minutes contract again? Because you say that the reason you're extending it is because of the AGM. What's going to happen?
Is coming up today. We've discussed that in the committee. We're looking at it at the end.
I left one small issue under slide 25. And I think some of the colleagues might have picked it up on SAA. You see, and it's the whole question of how you relate the going concern with the submission of financial statement. Maybe this first line, the way it's couched, might give an impression that the AG's office received preliminary financial statements. Because it says we have not received financial statements yet for audit due to South African Airways not meeting going concern. So you see, once you juxtapose the going concern with the receival of the financial statement, it's like you're motivating the case why the financial statements were not submitted. Therefore, it translates into a perception that suggests that it needs to first be a going concern before it can submit. And it can be the case. The two are not related. So can we have clarity how we derive this conclusion? Because it's going concern, it's on the basis of the management decision taken between itself and National Treasury in terms of provision of guarantees and any other matter. So it does not necessarily relate to showing the performance in the financial year. So the way it's couched, it leaves that. So can we maybe clean it up in a way that...
Quick reply, please.
Thanks a lot, Chair. I'll deal with the two issues. One being the issue, I'll deal with the last issue first, because I think the last issue is the most simplest, I think. The analogy is correct. However, when we don't get a set of financial statements, by the way, by the due date, we do engage the auditors to find out what's leading to that situation, which is us not getting the financial statements. And then the client would actually say, these are the reasons why you're not getting any set. So those were the reasons given to us as the auditors of SAA. As things stand, we didn't get a set, and the going concern was part of the reasons given as to why we're not getting a set of financial statements for auditing. On the issue of the disputes or the disagreements, Chair, the standard is very clear. When you reach a disagreement with the client, the standard provides you the basis on how you need to conclude an audit. However, looking at the nature of what is being disputed, it's very legal in nature. And to that extent, we've now engaged with SARS, not client to client at a point, but at a point where we actually used now letters, you know, from lawyers to say, no, our lawyers interpret this thing in this way, and their lawyers interpret this thing this way. So it becomes too much of a legal issue, which is what I said earlier on. However, if we get to a point where we're not seeing eye to eye, we will then follow the proper process as stipulated in the standard, which means we'll have to then close on a disagreement and then modify the opinion accordingly. I think that assists.
To engage in a laborious process, can I ask the last follow-up?
Very quickly, please.
Does it then suggest, based on the note, now that we have reached the end of September, does it suggest that given the fact that the SAA's going concern has been addressed by National Treasury, therefore you have received the financial statement? Have you? Because September has come to an end.
We haven't received any set of financial statements as yet.
See, the point I was making when I said if the reason becomes the going concern for auditing, it becomes immaterial because it's the 3rd of October, Chair. And the financial statement has not yet been submitted, even when the going concern has been addressed by National Treasury. I don't want to pull it, DG. You know what I'm talking about. I'm just highlighting it because I related it to the fact that it has been continuous, but SAA does not, and I wanted us to accept it, that it does not submit financial statements on time. And it's not related. It's
okay.
Not related to the matters of going
okay.
consent.
Thanks. Okay, that's done. Is there anything else you want to say, Solly?
Just on slide number 16, Honourable Chair, just to highlight the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. So if you go to slide number 16, the fruitless and wasteful expenditure for the 16-17 year is 17 million, of which 69 million is coming from National Treasury. And of that 69 million, 65 million was paid to Oracle for technical support. So Oracle, the software and the technical support, so the software licenses and the technical support was purchased and paid for in the 2016-17 year. However, the system is not yet implemented. So that's where they are paying for services for which, or they're paying for services which they are not receiving. Because usually you will get technical support once you have a system that is fully implemented. If you look at the irregular expenditure, which is the 140 million, 47.5 million of the 140 relates or comes from National Treasury, of which 28 million relates to the procurement of the central supplier database that Treasury procured without following the SCM process.
I just want to respond to the issues raised by Honorable Shibambo. The issue of the emergency fund, I've just been advised, it doesn't sit necessarily in the National Treasury. It sits in the National Revenue Fund, which is an audit that we are going to do in the month of October. Obviously, when we do the audit, we will then express an opinion on those accounts accordingly. Yeah. The KPMG matter, I think, as I've said, it obviously we make consideration of a whole lot of issues at hand. It is common knowledge that there is still further investigations. We've also taken into account the fact that, you know, steps have been taken, you know, within the KPMG to try and resolve some of the issues. As we said, we need to take a firm and informed decision once all the processes have obviously taken place. So that is the position that as an organization we have taken. Obviously, the issues that have been raised by Honorable Floyd are being taken into account as well. And as you said, Chair, when we do get the final report, we will obviously go back to the table and take our final view on it.
I'll send you the letter that questions the legality of what's been done. We've referred it to our lawyers and so on. And Frank, you will deal with it within a week, right? But we'll send you the letter anyway. All right. Thank you very much. We want to once again say to you that what you do for these committees, not just our own, is excellent work. And again, I think we're very struck by how young you are. So it's not just the skill and quality of what you bring to bear. It's very encouraging that you people are so young. Congratulations for your good work, and we are very grateful. Over then to the DM. He's explained that he has to leave soon, so he won't be able to stay till 5:30. We don't have to necessarily stay till 5:30. I'm getting endless SMSs, you can imagine, from who, about our 5:30 meeting. But look, we can't. Parliament takes precedence. So we'll sit here till 5:30. We have to. Over to you, DM, because you've got to leave shortly.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen. Obviously, I'm with the team, the DG on my left, DG, I'm so the other colleagues.
Yes, and good afternoon, honourable members. I'm with Ismail Momonia, to the D, the CFO, Celine Dile, Laura, Seme, who is the Chief Director responsible for strategy at the Treasury, Stadim Gomez Zulu, the Corporate Services DDG. We also have Zanele. Zanele is the Acting Accountant General. And we've got Willie Matebula, he must have stepped out, who is the Acting Chief Procurement Officer. And yes, and obviously some colleagues. Yes, yes.
Thanks, Chair. Obviously, we have started dealing with some issues which are appearing on the report. But we think that's it's an important thing in us accounting to the committee about what we are doing or what we have done in the past financial year. The context is also very important, that it's under very trying economic conditions, which continue to bedevil what we are trying to do in the department. Despite that, I think it is important that we should always strive to achieve more with resources which are shrinking, as per capita GDP is showing. Chair, a few things have been raised by the AG, and one would like to assure the committee and honorable members that those will continue to be on our on our focus, so that to make sure that we improve on those things. At all times, we think that as we engage with our responsibilities, the question of economic growth, the question of employment, the question of inequality and poverty should always be driving us as to how we deal with those challenges. I usually argue that any economic policy which doesn't touch on those things. It's not the words of the paper on which it's written. To balance numbers without impacting the real lives of our people doesn't make life better for us. We may achieve the numbers, we may do numbers, we may procure to the letter and spirit of the law, but if that doesn't touch the lives of our people, it definitely is not worth the paper on which it's written. So we need to do both, follow the law to the letter, but at the same time make sure that what we are doing to try and deliver those services and goods to South Africans and mostly also focus to the poorest of the poor. Together we are working hard to provide policy certainty, have acted and will continue to do so with agency to complete growth-enhancing structural reforms which are currently in progress and advance economic transformation, ensuring that more people participate in the economy by changing the structure, systems and institutions of the economy and patterns of ownership, management and control. Key among this, Chair, is the development, adoption and implementation of the Financial Services Charter. Working with other departments and entities as well as financial sector stakeholders, the new charter will advance transformation in the ownership and management of companies in the financial services sector. The modernization of the public procurement regime will not only deliver on its economic transformation mandate, which is very important, but will enhance the efficiency of the public sector and deliver on the value for money imperative. Chair, it's one of the things that we have identified, the question of using procurement to try and transform the economy. One of the things that have been identified in the public sector in general, but in our own space, is the paucity of the usage of black professionals, whether you're talking about auditors, you're talking about lawyers, architects, and so on and so forth. It's very important that we as government, we are seen to be trailblazers as far as that is concerned. That we have said, and there's definitely commitment from the department and the office of the chief procurement office that we do that. We can't expect other economic agents to transform, and what we are able to do, the levers that we are having, we don't use them. So there is that commitment, and we're staying very closer to that. The question of using procurement to make sure that we access the rural poor, the youth, the women, is also very important. Public procurement will further maximize the developmental impact of the public spend by targeting and increasing access to black women and youth-owned businesses, township entrepreneurs, and others. Going forward, Chair, we recognize that it is imperative that there is a recommitment to investment for growth, stabilization of the governance and finances of state-owned companies. It's one matter that you are always faced with, and from National Treasury side, we have said that we would like to be in a situation where the SOEs, if they are in the front page, they are in front page for good reasons. Whether you are talking to the holders of our bonds or to the rating agencies, the red lights of the SOEs always keep on coming up. So there's all determination and commitment from our side that we make sure that if we have SOEs on the front pages, that should be for good reasons. So governance and proper management of the SOEs, it's non-negotiable from our side. But as we deal with these challenges, Chair, it is common cause that the economy has been shrinking, and we had to revise the economic growth that was presented downwards. and that has got a direct impact on the resources that the government has for the transformation of the economy and for delivering the services to our people. this didn't just start yesterday. The South Africa and global economy have not recovered from the economic disaster of 2008. We're still faced with those challenges. Surplus that we once had in our budget is no longer there. So, but again, the challenge to all of us is that the resources, the legal resources that we have, we make sure that they are being efficiently used and the impact on the lives of our people. And I must add, Chair, that we welcome this interaction with the committee as the committee to look at what we are doing and listen to the committee. And no matter how difficult the questions and the issues that are raised, but from our side, we are very clear that that those things are meant to improve delivery of our services to our people. Chair, a lot of things on the 25th who are coming up, the minister will be delivering his MTPPS, and there are issues which are being raised, and the minister will definitely be dealing with most of those things in his MTPPS as a statement on the 25th of October. Thank you, Chair. Mazambane, that will be remembered. We'll factor in that as we deliver that medium-term budget policy statement.
Remember, this committee always holds people to account, right? And now you're going to be held to account.
thank you so much, Chair. The team is here, led by the DG, to interact with the report and to interact with the issues that have been raised with the auditor general. But again, the whole executive team, or most of the executive team, is here. Again, it's because we don't want to have reasons that so-and-so is not around, so that we are able to give explanations of the things that we did or we did not do. Thank you, Chair.
DG?
Thank you much, Honorable Chair. Good afternoon again to Honorable Members. Earlier on, I had wished, Chair, that we were given an opportunity to respond before members could ask, or in fact give our presentation, because most of the questions that honourable members had around specifics in the AG report are things that are captured in our report. So I've got colleagues, Laura and Slindile and Momo, will also come in at various parts in our presentation to you this afternoon, and in addressing most of the issues, especially around irregular expenditure and fruitless expenditure that was identified earlier on. Now, it is also important that we remain, I think that's what we must mention this afternoon, Chair, that we remain committed, and the period under review was very difficult for us, as the DM said, that obviously technical recession ended with a technical recession, the economy experienced a retraction in the last few months of the last financial year. So it has really been very difficult putting our minds together in terms of how best to stretch the rent that's currently in under our management. Now, as you all know, our duty and our job is twofold today. One is to give you a broader sense that the whole of government things are intact, and also to zoom in into the daily workings of the National Treasury and issues around the IFMS obviously come in, issues around the in particular those two different payments come in, and we will try and actually ensure that we explain that to detail. And in explaining that, I think also, and I'm saying it up front, that as the AG correctly said, Chair, the relationship between the auditee and the auditor is always contentious. There'll always be issues that we contend about and that we disagree, that we argue until the last moment. Now, this is no exception. I mean, we could have chosen, like the other departments do or other entities do or did, to not agree with the AG and for us to even postpone this hearing, because clearly there were key three issues that currently finally we agreed that we will disclose in the way we disclose today, that we are not in agreement with the AG. And it was a very difficult, painful process to agree, because we were divided as management, whether we agree or not with the irregular expenditure and the fruitless expenditure, because there clearly are explanations to that. We will do that right towards the end, in terms of what, at that point in time, what management thought it's appropriate, what management believed that it's actually acting in the interest of the state, and that unfortunately because of auditing processes we were found wanting. So we agreed finally after a very protracted engagement with the AG, but we will explain the details later. So without wasting any more time with the stuff that I had prepared, Chair, because the DM actually took everything and every word that I was going to mention, we will shortly just, Laura, for the purpose of this afternoon, because I know the committee is focused on the issues that the AG raised, we will, Chair, just focus on our achievables, our performance achievements in the 16-17 in a very brief way, and then we give Slindile to focus on our performance on a financial basis, and then we will end up with the stuff that is key for the discussions today. We have, in front of you, committee members, you have a presentation. Now, issues related to IFMS, we deliberately wanted to leave them there and put them as an annexure because we thought slide 24, 25, 26 will not explain in detail what exactly we meant. Slide 22, 23 would not be helpful enough for us to get deeper into the issues because, Honorable Tandi, the issues that are IFMS related are the issues that finally led us, one, two of those at least, led us to what critically now is an issue which is fruitless and wasteful in the way we acted, but we will definitely be able to explain. Laura, let me ask you to just take us through from slide 6 onwards. Thanks.
Thank you very much, DG, and good afternoon, committee. I'll mainly focus, because I have provided details for each program on our achievements as well as our non-achievements. I'll mainly focus on the slide that gives a graphical representation of National Treasury's performance for the last financial year, the reporting period under current review. Of our total number of indicators, we achieved 75, and the combined partially and not achieved was 25. As I agreed with the committee, at the end of the annual the year, we would combine partially and not achieved, and hence we've done it. Although we do want to indicate that in line with the AG's request, that better aligns expenditure to planning, we continue to indicate to you where there was partial achievement, i.e. more than 50% of the target was achieved, and therefore there would have been expenditure in that area. You will see that by far the majority of our programs, in fact all of our programs, achieved more than 50% of their targets. And whilst we recognize, and as I've indicated to the committee before, that the two areas that underperformance was in Program 5, which is the Office of the Accountant General and the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer. And just to once again indicate to the committee that Program 5 has by far the majority of National Treasury's indicators, and then therefore I would expect us to have more underperformance in that area, one. And two, that a number of our pilot programs, particularly in respect of the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer, would be tested during this period, and therefore we wouldn't expect them to have achieved at a optimal level yet. And finally, the Office of the Accountant General is heavily reliant on third parties, and often that is the reason why we have delayed, and it may not yet be underperformed, but definitely delayed performance. I will not be going into each of these pages I've provided for you. Sufficient to say that we've given you the key achievements for those programs. I'm sure the committee will recognize many of them. After all, we report to you regularly on them. We've provided you with the reference in terms of the annual report. But if the committee is interested in any particular program or particular achievement indicator, we will certainly provide that detail. So on that note, I can hand over to Slindile, the CFO.
Good afternoon, honourable members. Good afternoon, Chair. I'll be taking you through the financial information. On slide 15, just highlighting the HR matters. whereas the National Treasury, there was a 1.1% vacancy rate that was achieved and a total of 48 promotions. Highly moving to slide 16, where this is an overview of what we've audited, what has been audited and has already been presented in the previous quarter. Basically, what it shows is what was appropriated versus what National Treasury spent. You will see on the pie charts, it's basically aligned except for just program four, where it was 18% or 1% basically over what was appropriated. Slide 18 just clarifies the economic classifications as well as 19 in terms of graphical overview of what was achieved by National Treasury. Slide 20 focuses on the deviations, basically on what we had planned versus what was achieved, mostly the underspending, which has been basically aligned on above slides. Slide 21 will focus on the AG report. Basically, as the National Treasury, we did receive an unqualified audit with emphasis of meta on the issues that will be highlighted below. Also, as well as on our predetermined objective, overall, it was an unqualified audit with emphasis of meta. Obviously, as I've said, the emphasis of meta resulted from the material findings on compliance issues that we had to adjust the financial statements, as well as we had to disclose fruitless and wasteful expenditure, as well as an irregular expenditure, which is on slide 22. The first on the fruitless and wasteful expenditure is also the Auditor General has explained. The 67 million is based on the IFMS Oracle payment for support services, as well as, well, that was the major one in terms of the 69 and as well as the payment of premises. And then the irregular expenditure focuses on expansion of the locus contract, which is the CSD, as well as the incorrect allocation on BEE points in terms of a supplier. Also, it will include prior figures in terms of the CSD, hence the 28 million that was highlighted by the Auditor General. The remedial actions, Honorable Chair, have been listed on slide 23, basically outlining what we have, as a result of the irregular expenditure as well as fruitless, that we've dedicated an audit committee also to strengthen the processes of the audit process to ensure that whatever remedial actions that we are taking, we take accountability for. And as a result, we will also be reporting to EXCO to ensure that we obviously keep progress and make sure that we take corrective steps timeously, as well as the audit committee as well, in order to make sure that we take action of where we were found wanting in terms of the process. As the DG has explained that in certain matters, it's a matter of interpretation of the PFMA versus us as the department as well as the Auditor General, where we may not have agreed on certain issues, but obviously for progress sake and taking accountability, we did disclose these matters, which obviously in the addendum we have detailed in, we have explained in detail in terms of IFMS as well as the CSP. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I think, Chair, now in relation to IFMS in particular, we will be more than happy to come to the committee. We have engaged the Appropriations Committee and we have engaged SCOPA. We are more than ready, but we can just give the...
really unnecessary. Appropriations dealing with it, SCOPA is dealing with it. But you can respond to the issues raised today.
Okay.
So, Chair, just to deal with the issue, so we get to slide 26, because we did feel that...
Particularly the financial management system, DG, is that what you're responding to?
Yes.
Okay.
As you know, I don't deal with IFMS, but I think when it's been in the news, as management, we went into the matter just to check for ourselves what the issues were. And I think, Chair, to make the first point, we were sitting on IFMS 1 from 2000 to 2013. Then Cabinet approved in 2013 that we replace IFMS 1 with IFMS 2. And this was on the recommendation of both the Ministers of Finance and Public Service and Administration. So it wasn't just one minister, it was two ministers involved. The process for IFMS 2, whilst it's on the budget of the Treasury, it's jointly managed by a steering committee made up of National Treasury, the Department of Public Service and Administration, and CETA. IFMS was, in the jargon, and don't ask me what they mean, a hybrid solution, and that was replaced by, where we tried to basically use systems that we could buy, but also develop our own custom-based systems with custom of the shelf system, COTS. Okay, so it was replaced by that, and for that, just so that you know, Chair, the objective was to replace the legacy IT systems, which are BAS, Purcell, Logos. In fact, Purcell is very important because it makes sure that we get paid on the 15th, for example. And these both sort of involve, you know, looking at procurement, HR management, financial management, catalog management, payroll integrated data exchange. So once Cabinet had decided, Chair, on the COTS solution, the procurement process started in 2014. Obviously, these were put out for public notice, and the process took a long time and finished there was an award to Oracle in April 2016. I should add, you know, before this, there was a lot of work that was done even before 2013 with the Gartner report, World Bank report. There were three sort of technical inputs about how best to proceed. So this was a very long and considered process. And, you know, in our view, given the contract, that we got a pretty favorable discounts, which we negotiated on the back of government committing to purchase licenses and technical support over the first 5 years. I should point out that the audit opinions for previous years did not raise any material issues related to the award of the IFMS contract or its management. Chair, to move on, the next page 27 or slide 27. I just want to point out the issues raised by the audit opinion today is quite different from the issues that have been raised in the internal audit unit report that was leaked to the media. And it was leaked without response by management. The audit opinion largely covers, I think, as you've seen, ICT work settlement and payment of licenses, whilst the internal audit unit report was looking at some weaknesses in control, all of which I want to emphasize management responded to. DG Fuzile acted promptly when the audit committee requested that they also wanted a forensic investigation. He immediately agreed to it. In fact, we in the Treasury are very keen this should come out because, there's been an issue where the audit committee was not happy with the contract to do this forensic by Deloitte. And so there's still a process now to restart this forensic investigation. I think the AG, Sadi had made the point that, in fact, we say it more carefully, no allegation has been made of corruption against any Treasury official, no allegation made of corruption or of any Treasury official benefiting financially from IFMS in both the audit opinion and in the internal audit unit reports. Indeed, I want to say, Chair, we'll act speedily as management if any corruption or wrongdoing is done by any of us. And I should add, many of us are willing to take lifestyle audits every year to prove it. And maybe that's a good suggestion to put in place because we have a lot of power.
Are you referring to the people accused in the IMF process or generally?
Generally, all of everybody. They are willing to come,
yeah,
despite what you see in certain TV stations. Okay. No. Our integrity is very important.
People accuse you of corruption.
Our integrity is very important, and we will stand for it.
Good. Fine.
I think, Chair, now what happened with the, to explain, when you had the close up of the IFMS, remember, one, this was going on. Government decides to change course. What happened then was there were contractors who were working on IFMS 1. Many of them were willing to let that end. You negotiated the major companies. But one company in particular, ICT Works, we could not come to an agreement. And they were, in fact, threatening to sue us because for damages if we didn't continue to pay them. So I deal with that in more detail. And to make the point that, firstly, they did win a tender, and you see this now it's not in the report itself, that ICT Works won a tender to provide services for IFMS 1. That's a number there. It says 2007 must be the year they got it. Once Cabinet decided, as I said, with those suppliers who we couldn't reach agreement, we obviously had to negotiate an exit for them from contractual arrangements. As you know, as government, we have to stick to our contractual arrangements. And following extensive negotiations and legal advice, and I mean, involving senior counsel, government was advised to enter into a settlement agreement in view of payment of damages. Now, we were able then to agree on an amount of 383 million, whereas the amount was just under 800 million rands. And initially, we would have had to pay that money out. But in negotiating the 383 million, ICT Works still had to provide services to government on IFMS 2. So we thought it's a good outcome. I think there was agreement that it made total business sense. And here's where we had a difference. When the DG says there was robust discussion, we were saying, but if there's a legal settlement and you varied the contract, how can you have a procurement process? Our legal advice said we didn't need a legal a procurement process. The AG's office read that our legal opinion was saying that. We clarified it with the senior counsel that we didn't need a procurement process because it would have been a fake procurement. It would have simply meant that we had to give ICT Works whatever, So when you have a variation in contract, and the PFMA does allow for that, yes, there are no regulations. So there were some technical issues, but we accepted because we feel the Auditor General's office is an important institution. I think the second issue on Oracle licenses with technical support, again, here we had some robust discussions with the Auditor General's office. We believe that the contract we had was cost effective, and it had an arrangement that you had to pay for technical support every year. And I should emphasize, the technical support is not where you phone for support. It's about, as they're implementing, that you kind of, there's coding, there's upgrading, you want to make sure that people can't hack into the system so you get the latest upgrades. Because even had we not paid the license, what we showed, and the way I understand it, it's not my area, but having looked at this, was even if we didn't pay 67 million, say, in the first year, and we've had to pay in year two, if we use the technical support in year three, we would still have to back pay what we should have paid in year one and in year two with penalties. So we felt it's better to pay every year, and that's in terms of the contract. Now, you can say that it was a bad judgment call, but our estimate was that there was an upfront saving of 149 million rands, and over 20 years of a further 719 million rands. So we would argue it was a good business decision, and it's a good contract, and the key question really is how the audit process deals with such contracts, because maybe there are other ways, but this was the approach that the Treasury took. It was not raised at the time, obviously, of the contract, but once we started paying, it became an issue.
So on this, I must just add on the same point that, however, as much as at the time when we took this decision last year under the period under review, that doesn't stop us from engaging and opening up negotiations with Oracle to say, you know, to realistically now look at, because effectively you are paying for services that have not as yet been rendered. But I think it's something that we should be prepared to engage and open up negotiations once more with Oracle.
And that's exactly, we I think what the DG means is that having had this experience, we will still go back to them to see if we can mutually agree to a different arrangement, which will be more in line with the Auditor General's approach. That's what we want to do. Chair, on the third issue of the LOGOS CSD, what does CSD stand for? Customer Support.
Central
Supply Database, upgrade. I think here, just when we went into the matter, I think we were clear that we have a service level agreement with the provider currently. LOGOS is an old system, and I think the important thing to recognize is currently we're running two systems, the old system and the new system supposed to take over. There's been a decision now not to upgrade the old systems, but there were some urgent, there's always some urgent requirements either the system falls down or with the central database, I think, was quite a priority. And we believe that the enhancement made, because it was made in two amounts, I think 13 million and 15 million, spaced apart, but that it fell within the service level agreement because it's an enhancement. The AG's office felt, no, it's a new system. I think it's very cheap to buy a new system for, 28 million rands. We felt it's an enhancement to LOGOS. So if you regard it as a new system, then the AG's office sort of persuaded us that it requires a new procurement process. Okay. And I think the challenge, if it's an enhancement, no. Because also if you get a new, the way I understand it, if you put new, if you get another provider, they will still have to make that system talk to LOGOS. So, you know, and I'm not an IT expert, so I've been advised, okay? So, so how does, you know, for me, the audit process, like the DG says, we could have strung this out and said, look, let's get expert advice whether this is new or enhanced. We felt it's not worth going into it. So sadly, I think with these approaches, you know, we've been forced to accept irregular and fruitless expenditure. But we think that there are very good business decisions that were made and that can explain why we have the problems that are there. So I hope I've not gone overboard, but I think it's important that we put the case forward. Thanks, Chair.
This could guide the committee, right? This matter is being dealt with by SCOPA and by the Appropriations Committee. You have presented the same report to those two committees. Why not?
Let the DG come. But these are different issues.
Oh. Yes. The interest of SCOPA and interest of SCO was on the internal audit report initially,
right,
in terms of what that leaked report said and the kind of issues that it was raising. We're only dealing with that part. Now, what the AG, these are issues that are coming through from the audit process, so they belong here today.
Right.
And that's why we thought about the
background. Okay, that's helpful,
background.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's a nice way of defining. Because in our report to Parliament, see, what we don't want to do is to write things in our report, recommendations and observations, that conflict now with SCOPA and then conflict with the report that will come from Appropriations. That is why my own suggestion informally to the one chair was that we do it jointly. Well, Pinky raised it also. I said, fine, if people want to do something, maybe have joint meetings. That's all I'm a bit worried about. So, Zakele and Antonia, can you pitch this section of the report in a particular way? And then I will, so that we don't find a situation where we've got completely conflicting
recommendations from different committees. That's what I'm suggesting. Yes, Tandi?
Sure. There's no obligation on behalf of SCOF to be in tandem with the reports of SCOPA, especially if we don't share perspective. And Momo will understand why I want to pursue this issue. You see, when the AG wants to insist that when you enhance locus, it becomes a new procurement, and there's an argument that says based on the IT system, it's an enhancement. That matter must be cleared. It cannot go into the annual report as an irregular or a fruitless exercise, because then the AG's office must provide expect proof as to why they've come to that conclusion, because you dealt with the contract and the procurement of that service, and that's why I was asking whether is there going to be a new variation. If there isn't, and if it's based on the fact that it's an enhancement and you don't have to go to tender for you to relook at it, then there's disputable facts from what the AG has. It makes me, myself, sitting here to dispute those facts. And given the limitation of my expertise in this relation, but those who have dealt with the tender processes must then provide that argument. Because we might move from a wrong premise in terms of what is termed as fruitless or irregular expenditure. And you see, Chair, I'm not setting a precedent, AG's office, to question the AG's notes. But you see, it's very important that at a point where we agree to disagree or we agree to agree, there should be expect proof provided, either in a form of an attachment based on how our procurement systems are seen or looked. Because the follow-up question I would have wanted to raise from the AG is that, have you tested the procurement systems to see whether, when you came to the conclusion that this was a new tender and not an enhancement, that you were able to come to that conclusion? Because that should be the question that needs to be answered. And you see, at this late stage of even asking that question, it won't change the audit outcome as it stands in the current conjuncture based on the conclusion that the AG's office has come to. And it's got a serious repercussion, Chair. Even in the management task going forward in terms of even the Oracle system as in when you use it. Because once the observation is not on the correct purview in terms of when the contract was conceived and how over the years it will unfold, including what the differences will be paid as and when you negotiate DG. Because DG raised the fundamental question here that they still have an opportunity to engage further on this, and yet the conclusion has already been made. So whatever that you will come to terms with as part of your engagement, once this decision has been taken in this particular format by the AG, it's not going to change the history books that you are seen as having spent in a fruitless manner. So I will want them to explain, especially on that one, whether have they looked into the procurement and the tender procedures that were applied when this system was procured. Chair, I'm not trying to actually to pull and drag the discussion of IFMS. I'm just trying to get to understand, because when I tried to follow the discussions, I could not get the gist of the matter as to at what point a variation was seen from the level of the AG's office.
Right. Okay, we'll come back to that. Are there any other issues? But you see, Tandi, I think you may be right. I'll think about it and come back to you with a position. I'll speak to Frank also. You may be right that we don't need to necessarily be synergists with SCOPA because they're all different. But with our fellow committee, appropriations, that's actually different, right? Because, you know, we meant to work together, and it's really one committee that's split into two. Now I think we need three committees. That's my view, really. But let's not go that. So what else do you want to respond to or say, DG, before we come to each of the issues here?
Chair, we are fine. We are fine.
Anybody else would say anything? No, nobody from your team. Right. In that case, questions? Can we have Floyd, Tandi? Nobody else. And then when we finish with the members, then we come to, obviously, the staff. So it's Floyd and Tandi, and then it's Gloria. Since there's Mr. Lees, and then it's Gloria.
No, I think we should have not agreed that the Deputy Minister leaves, because most of the issues that we have to deal with are political questions, like which should be responded to by the politicians. So maybe let's just ask the basic things, like maybe there will be information that we'll get around some of the issues. I think very much earlier in September we asked on a mechanical issue, like it's not a policy issue, that how many staff members is the minister allowed to employ in the ministry, and how many is employed this far? Does the DG know? And I hear this talk, like even in the introduction here of this report by the minister, about the transformation of the financial services sector and the issues that have to be attended to, and the financial services charter and all of those things, that, and the financial services summit and all of those things. How do we marry that with the process that we've been engaged in, I think, for a long period of time now, on the transformation of the financial sector? Like, how does National Treasury intend to marry that process? Because I don't think we're just engaging in a fruitless process of calling banks and all role players in the financial sector, the Reserve Bank, everyone came to make presentations, civil society. We're finalizing a report now. What becomes the status vis-a-vis the intentions of the Ministry of Finance of transformation in the financial sector? Also, because what some members of the department are saying is not consistent with what the ministry is saying. There's a huge difference between what the ministry and the department says. So the ministry has got the appetite to transform the financial services sector, and some people in the department are saying everything else is fine. The second last issue is, the AG just said now that SAA has not submitted the financial statements for auditing purposes. Is the SAA AGM going to happen on the 3rd of November? That's a direct question. Is the AGM going to happen without audited financial statements on the 3rd of November, as you committed in the last meeting? And then the last issue is, maybe then the explanation. I don't know what you agreed with the chairperson of the committee before the 7 minutes, which I was not here, about the usage of the emergency fund to bail out SAA. When you came here, you said that there are a variety of options that you're looking into. You said you were aware that the banks might not want to roll over the loan, and we're considering a lot of things. It's not only the selling of Telkom, it's not only some of the issues that were reported about in the media, and then boom, you have gone to the emergency fund to take 3 billion rand, which the law says must be used for emergency purposes and for unforeseen circumstances. What is the justification of that? Like, let's get that, because if we were to subject that to a legal test, I don't think that National Treasury would survive. If we were to have a judicial review of that decision of using emergency fund, when there was enough time for a proper appropriation process, which could have been dealt with differently. When there was a problem in ESCOM, we disagreed ourselves, but there was a proper appropriation process. We disagreed with the manner in which it was tabled and how it got to be misused and everything else. I want the official explanation of National Treasury on why the emergency approach was taken to bail out SAA. And because also we need some assurance that it do not just be invaded like that in a reckless and unthinkable way, that someone will just decide to take money from the emergency fund without even appraised parliament. There was not even a hint to us and as an oversight body that there will be invasion of the National Revenue Fund in the manner in which it has been invaded. Sure.
Please, right? I stand.
Chair, I'm not going to be long. I just want the DG to pay attention to the issue that might come up now and then, the whole issue of the automating of the systems and how the issue of the CPF is being attended to. It will hamper Program 5 as and when we do not move with speed. Because remember, for the past two financial years, we have set this outsourcing of services in relation to this program remains a challenge. So I don't know how can we fast track the process of dealing with it. I know that this strategic procurement framework will be an answer to some of the challenges that we want to deal with. But I don't know. I don't want to be difficult. You see, Chair, I know that I've watched the DG answering so many questions on the other side, and then it's us here, and it's Floyd, and it's everybody else. I'm trying to be as nice as possible, you know. No, you will not understand. Even you don't understand what I mean even when I use the word nice. You don't know. Nice doesn't necessarily mean nice, but it means something else, you see. So, Mom, I don't know. Let's find a way. Because this is your program 5 is your most strategic one, and I don't want to foresee a situation where people come after you on this one in the near future and say, yeah, and then... Chair, you know what I'm saying, man.
Beat that. That means you speak for 14 seconds, proportionately, right? Because Tandy spoke for less than 2 minutes. So no, not 14, minus 14.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. DG, I'm curious about this fruitless expenditure on the new development bank and the rental on the premises. Why was it fruitless? I don't understand why that's been put as fruitless. Irregular, perhaps, but why fruitless? And then the question of the robust discussions with the Auditor General, and I understand that you've come to a conclusion to get the job done. You don't accept the view of the Auditor General in some of these instances, but it's moved on. In the case of SAA, which is an entity under your control, why are, or perhaps you are, perhaps I'm phrasing this wrongly, are you not insisting that audit be done? Is it SAA who is holding back, or are you party to the holding back? In terms of doing that audit and getting that done, because I completely see the picture in terms of your own audit, but it seems to me perhaps you've got a different view about SAA. And then, Mr. Chairman, in terms of I'm not sure, we had said we wouldn't be discussing it, but now we are discussing it in terms of the use of Section 16.
and providing a framework for it as agreed. Now, this is it. And then the committee can decide to outvote me. You see, we got a letter. No, please. I have to chair. It's simple. We got a submission, which sounds credible on the surface. I browsed through it, which says at about 10 to 2, and we emailed it to everybody. It came at 8:16, I think. Eh? Yeah, but we only saw it then. So we've now sent it to Frank. It sounds credible, I must say, DG, with due respect, right? That can you use the emergency fund for this? That's unforeseen and so on. That's credible. Whether it's legal or not is something that we're asking Frank to look at. So that decision was taken at 2 o'clock, we all agree. That let's give it to the lawyer and they can come back within 48 hours on Thursday or so we can look at that. So that's the issue of whether it's legal or not. Right. Now, the second issue that arises is when you, Tandi, please. I'm the acting whip, right? Right. So when you are asked whether it's legal or not and why you did it, that's fine. You can answer that. But for the committee to decide whether it's legal or not, it's not something we can sit here as non-lawyers to decide. So the two issues are related, but we are very clear. We're not going to open up the debate. You can do so. I'll go and have a cup of tea. You come back and tell me what you've decided. We've agreed that as a committee, we will take no decision on whether it's legal or not until Frank has come back within a certain time, probably 48 hours is reasonable, and tell us on Thursday morning, guys, this is what I think. It's not legal. In which case, if it's not legal, then hey, there's no debate here unless you can prove to us it's legal. But obviously, when you made the decision, that's a separate matter about the committee. Now, what you're being asked is a separate issue, which is when you did it last week or whenever, it's correct what Floyd says. You suggested a whole lot of options, including a hint that you might go to the PIC, right? You said that's one, but you never suggested to this committee you might go to the emergency fund, at which case the DA or whoever would have said, well, can you do that? So you can answer the question from the point of view of a DG deciding, but from the committee's point of view, we need legal advice, right? Now, the other thing to say, to be fair, is that, am I correct in saying this? Maybe you can help Frank if I'm not. It is, if you come with an appropriations bill, it does not come to us. It goes, as appropriations bill, needless to say, do, to the appropriations committee. Is that correct? It doesn't come to us. Frank, am I right? Good, as long as members are aware of that. Now, you can answer the question. What do you want to say, Floyd?
Carry on now.
Can you finish up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Indeed, then I will build on that subject a bit, because at the last meeting, DG, I actually raised the Section 16 possibility. Yes. And so I don't remember you discounting it. I'm pretty sure you wouldn't have done anyway, even if my memory was better than it is. So that was very soon, not very recently, and yet that was ultimately the route that we went. But DG, it doesn't. I don't think the $3 billion give the status of a going concern. And so if it doesn't give the status of a going concern, then the going concern status assumption can't be made before the 3rd of November. So what are the implications here in terms of that? Because the chair has just pointed out, if it comes in the form of an appropriation, it will then go through the MTBPS process, which I think you've asked us to be patient about, and that's the process that's going to follow. That process, I think, culminates on the vote on, I think, the 29th of November, somewhere around there. So, there's the 3rd of November seems to be a date that's unachievable unless it's a qualified audit. And I've tried to tease this out, and I'm trying to tease it out of you now by saying, you know, on the one hand, with your own audit, you've accepted the auditor's view, surely on SAA we must just go ahead then if we're going to achieve that 3rd of November date. It must now go ahead as and be qualified as a without the going concern assumption. It doesn't mean to say the thing stops. It's an audit, it's an assumption by the board, which the audit then can auditor confirms. What action is taken is another subject altogether. Please point out if I'm all wrong on this.
Same page as you are. Can I also raise a question for clarity before anybody else speaks? Am I correct to say that an appropriations bill has to go through both houses? Is that correct, Frank? So at the earliest, you see, the DA rightly, we agreed with you. When you raised this thing about the 3rd of November is not doable, remember? Then it struck me absolutely right. Never mind the DA raised it. I know one of the members gets upset if it's the DA. But you're raising a factual thing. It can't be the 3rd of November, which raises the question also, as it did in my head the last time, why would Treasury say 3rd of November, knowing you're likely to bring us an appropriations bill, knowing, too, that it has to go through two houses, knowing, too, its earliest you'll get it processed by both houses is the first or second week of December. Now, then the question, Frank, is, if it goes through both houses, when it comes to an appropriation bill, does it have to be sanctioned by the President promulgating it, or in this case, it's a done deal? Once Parliament decides, say by the end of the first week of December.
Sure, it must still be signed by the President.
To effect in January. That rules out having an AGM with a going concern. They're absolutely right. The DA raised it day one. Yes, you want to say something, Frank? Just help us before Floyd comes
yeah,
in.
I mean, if there's confusion, the letter from the Minister on 20 September already indicates that the AGM is going to be in 2019. So the question is...
Oh, not 2019, please. 2018.
Chair, let me see. Now, I'll quote, she again appointed for the third term on 1 September as chairperson, which term will expire at the AGM in 2019.
A term will expire in 2019, and I saw that. But the AGM will be held,
in
presumably,
2018,
if he mentions anything apart from this year.
But a term was not appointed for 3 years in any event.
Yeah, no, that's slightly... That we're looking at the end of
fair
the meeting,
enough.
Where you're going to give us your legal opinion about the legality of the extension of a term, right? We agreed this morning, we will look at it in the law. Otherwise, it will distract us. But the issues being raised now, DG, those are correct. Floyd?
No, I'll raise this concern maybe later. I've got a problem with this thing of having to be overlined on the lawyer who sometimes gives contradictory opinions on one issue. I've got a serious problem. Like, we even suspend discussions because they won't listen to a lawyer. No, it's out of order. On the same issue of SAA, he came the other day to give a certain opinion, and then when he goes home, he realizes that he is not consistent, and then he gives a different...
No, fine, that's your opinion, you're entitled
but
to...
But if he wants to be a member of Parliament, he must contest elections. Like, these
no,
other committees that will sit in, the other committees will sit in, don't do it in this fashion that
it's
being...
No,
it's out of order.
Right now, I'm chairing, and this is the way we operate.
It's irresponsible, you are lousy chair. That is how you chair,
right,
it's lousy.
Right.
Every time lawyer must participate in our committees.
Yeah, fine. Can we
check,
move on?
Check,
I think you shouldn't insult Frank Jenkins, really.
Yes, and in his
subject.
Presence,
yeah.
it's not, please, Chair. No, but no.
Frank, you wanted to say something about the legal issue?
I mean, if I need to defend myself, those were two separate issues. There were two. It was what the
I mean,
deputy minister
that,
said. Yes, no, it's unfair,
on, yes.
Chair. I'm not going to stand for that in any way.
Yeah. Then, is there any other issue related to the use of Section 16 that you want to raise? Not whether it's legal or not. From the point of view of the committee, we'll get the legal advice. Now, Dondo, Comrade Dondo, can you, so DG, can you reply?
Thank you, Chair. I think it is only fair if we also explain to the committee what we've been explaining to the media on in the last few weeks. We used Section 16 on the 30th of June in paying Standard Chartered in passing in to SAA for Standard Chartered to meet their for SAA to meet their obligations to Standard Chartered, and then we used again last week as you correctly said the 3 billion now. And I'm not talking to the legality of it, the rationale behind, as Honorable Shivam was asking. I think with what's available or what was available at our disposal at the time,
we particularly took this route for two reasons. One was a default on SAA side would have meant a call on the guarantee by the banks. Now, for me, that's catastrophic in this way. If SAA or any state-owned company cannot meet its obligation, and then we come in terms of the guarantee that we've issued. Remember, we've got 16.9 billion rand worth of guarantees to SAA. If we cannot meet, the SAA cannot meet its obligation, therefore, there's a call on a guarantee. We'll be forced then to pay the 16.9 with various lenders. And when that happens, the other fear is that then there's a hole, and that's my big interest, by the way. The plus 250 billion rand worth of guarantees across the whole of state-owned companies. That for me is huge, is big. If it happens, then it can really bring this country down. And that's where I think the use of such became Section 16 provision became an emergency on my part to actually motivate that we go that route. We looked at various options, and we said it. I was the one to say it here in the committee that we are looking at various options. And one of the options, by the way, I remember, I even mentioned the special appropriation bill. Now, it's one thing to just say it. It's one thing to also look at the timelines and the time frames confirmed by the legal advisor in the room to say it would have meant that the president only assents in January, as an example. And in terms of such, obviously there's provision that as to how much you can use in terms of spending, I mean, those provisions are there in law, and then we would have taken care of. So again, the special appropriation bill option fell on the wayside because it wouldn't have been possible. One, Parliament was in recess even at the time when we thought we would be. Second, it wouldn't have been possible. If I have to turn back to the February Minister of Finance's budget speech, at the time, Chair, we confirmed through the speech that will recapitalize SAA and SAPO. Now, we didn't mention the amount in February, if you go back to the appropriation process then, because at the time we were assessing the financial challenges of SAA. There were various studies that were undertaken. In particular, we appointed Seabury Consulting to give us some piece of work, which they did, and came to the conclusion that SAA, to come back to its feet, to be on its sustainability drive, etc., it needed the recapitalization of 13 billion. Now, in using Section 16 in June, in using Section 16 now, and going to the 25th of October to regularize, in law, Chair, there's a provision, and we wrote to you to inform the committee within 14 days after 30th of June, we are expected again, even now, to do exactly the same, to inform within 14 days, or at the earliest, the appropriation process, meaning during the appropriation, adjusted appropriation in October, which will then regularize the 2.2 billion and the 3 billion, including what government thinks is the correct amount to recapitalize SAA in the current financial year. And that amount, again, we said it's 10 billion in 17-18. Now, does 3 Honorable Liz, does 3 billion or 10 billion, as I think, gives SAA the comfort that it seems to be a going concern? I think it does, if it's 10. What I have done, Chair, last week, with the insistence of management in SAA, and they've been insisting with on us for a while, but there were other internal government processes that needed to take place. I didn't want to just go and give a letter, a comfort letter, whatever letter, that tells SAA that you've got 5 or 10 or 20 billion, and that you're good to go, you can pass your financial statements. Now, after internal government process that culminated into Treasury agreeing to a recapitalization process, an amount of 10 billion, I gave SAA management that letter last week, whereby confirmed the 2.2, confirmed the 3 billion and the balance, and say to them that will be regularized in the medium-term budget policy statement. Now, after that happens on the 25th of October, then there are parliamentary processes that unfolds through going to two houses until finally through ascension by the president. That's the process. So I, insofar as this matter is concerned, that involves SAA, I think that's how we've been dealing with it. And now, you can ask, but is that an option? Yes, you are right. The moment
Chair, on a soft note, whatever I say here is Momo who taught me all of these things. Momo taught me that you don't leave any option out. I never ruled that out in when we were last year as Section 16 being an option, because it will have ultimately been the last. But I think carefully looking at Section 16, we are careful in looking at that. We didn't just decide, because my worry would have still remained the same, that if there's a call on SAA guarantee, there's Denel, there's ESCOM guarantees, there's SABC, there's almost state-owned companies that have guarantees. So that was the main reason why we went on to Option 16. Now, so in terms of the AGM, I think that's a process that I think the committee is handling with the minister, in terms of exactly when, whether it's, we did say yes, that it's going to take place on the 3rd. And by the way, we did at the time link that. And we said, and we've been saying it, even now we're saying it, that the issue relating to the chair of the board will be addressed at the AGM. That's what minister said, and that's what we said. Now, if the date is January of 2018 or January of 2019 in terms of the AGM, I think commitment has been made by the Minister of Finance, not by me, Chair, that the issue will be addressed by the minister at the earliest convening. He understands, and I also understand, and our advice has always been that it is important that this matter is dealt with swiftly, the matter of addressing the issue of the chair of the board of SAA. It's important because in our conversations with lenders, because they extended, others apart from Citi, the issue obviously of the chair came out and how we have to deal with it, and many other conditions that they have put, including some of the conditions that we have set for ourselves. Because one of the things that we said is that we are not just going to give SAA money and not put any conditions to that. We are, and we will continue, and most of those firmed up conditions will obviously be finalized on the 25th of October when we do the last tranche, which is of the 10 billion, which I think at that time all committees in Parliament, and as I said, the parliamentary process will have to kick in after the Minister of Finances proposes through the appropriation process a 10 billion rand allocation to SAA, including, as I said, in SAPO. And in February, when we said that in the current financial year, we will, or in the oncoming financial year, we will recapitalize SAA and SAPO. And that's what we're doing, the process. One can argue that, yes, the process is not ideal. Yes, it's not ideal. We should have done it. I mean, if we came with an early appropriation on time to give the we should have done that. But again, the 25th of October is coming to deal with that matter. I hope I have addressed the Section 16 issue and the SAA.
Okay, I don't think so completely, but I think let's now, you see, the issue that will arise is whether it's legal or not, and that's a legal matter. And so, once again, I return to Frank giving us a legal opinion, and then you've asked for a legal opinion, am I right? That's what you actually requested in your letter. So that legal opinion will be given by Frank, and Frank confers with his entire legal unit. He doesn't just come here as an individual. Can I stress this to members who may not know this? Am I right, Frank? You can't just give your own legal opinion. You have to go through your legal unit,
that's correct. They
must approve of it,
yes.
Right? Including your head. What's the name? Adhikari or something?
My
yes, so that's how it's done. It's not an individual does it, but go ahead, Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that. I'm not going to get into that at all. I just want to... I also don't, I can't remember what the word that Tandi was using. I don't want to be difficult. But DG, if you've already given a comfort letter to SAA, you're already committing Parliament to this appropriation. Maybe I heard wrongly. DG saying you've given a comfort letter for 10 billion, in other words, the 2.2 and the 3 and another 5. To SAA so they can get on with their financial statements. In other words, they can assume that they're a going concern. And, I mean, if you need to... Mr. Chairman, I might have heard all wrong, but that's how I heard it, and that worries me if that is the case, because basically the DG, and I assume the Minister, have jumped ahead of Parliament. And that's exactly the problem I have with using Section 16, because in a sense it puts a gun to the head of Parliament, you know, and said, well, we've given them the money already. If I'm wrong, please tell me I'm wrong, DG. Just tell me I'm wrong, because I hope I'm wrong. And then, Mr. Chairman, in terms of Dudu Mnyeni's term of office,
because it's going to distract. That's a slightly separate issue. He's going to give us that opinion and
okay.
So on. Can we just deal with that, yeah?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy with that. And then, Mr. Chairman, the other thing is then, DG is quite right, and I mean, I'm really pleased that there are going to be conditions and so on. I am a bit concerned that those conditions aren't yet in place, as we've already given them $5.2 billion. But nevertheless, you say by the 25th of October, an auspicious day in my life, those conditions could we be given those conditions, please, Mr. Chair?
This thing. The committee has repeatedly raised this, Mr. DG, that we can't just give money. You yourself say the minister was very eloquent on this the first time he appeared with SA. I remember shortly after he got appointed. We can't give money like that. It's almost unconditional. We have been raising with you and Praveen Godan and so on, appoint at least one, possibly two people with aviation expertise. It's dragging on and on and on. Now, I know what you're going to reply. You need to look at it holistically. But now if your AGM is not going to happen, why can't you already, looking at it holistically, appoint some of those vacancies, the expertise we've been saying, and you and Praveen Godan and the current minister have said you're going to do? Secondly, there's nothing that emerges in the public domain about what exactly you are asking in return from SAA for this money. And, you know, we don't know. You will say that you're doing this thing in internal meetings, but I think the public, whose money this is, and on whose behalf Parliament actually acts as custodians, needs to know what is it, you know. I was stuck in meetings and they all started ringing me, right, about this issue. Remember, you also tried to phone me. It was on Friday. And the first thing I was going to say, if I ever spoke to any media person, I only got out of the meeting at 9:25 p.m. I flew on a 9:25 flight. But what I'll say to you is, we are not, you know, given what we said before, there's nothing to do with party politics. We feel you and the minister need to do more to explain to the public what is it you're getting back in return. What are the stringent conditions you're putting for all this money? What are you asking for in terms of governance? Why is it that the managers that are there, apart from the new CEO is emerging, are there? What are you asking for in return? Can you give us like 8 to 10 things for what you're asking for in return? It'll go to appropriations, but we also want to know. Thank you. Loan, I mean, this allocation of money, is there anything else quickly? Because we've got other issues, right? This is not just about that. On the legal matter, that's the last item on the agenda. Now, can we quickly have, Floyd, you want to say something?
Yes, Chair. Can you please, now I'm not going to listen to the legal opinion. I'm going to get our own senior counsel also to give us proper advice, not what you're going to listen to. So I'm going to speak about issues that are legal, because I think my perspective might be better than what is going to be given now. Now, I don't know whether the word crazy is allowed, but I think it's crazy. The whole thing that National Treasury is engaged in now is absolutely crazy. The fact of the matter is that part of the crisis of SAA is the leadership crisis. That's why I say that the politicians should have been here so that we then tell them that don't do this to our country. Like, don't do that. Like, there might be functional issues and your own interest, but please don't do that to our country. Like, you know that some of the lenders are not comfortable with the leadership instability in SAA now, but we're insisting that Dudu must remain there. We are not giving a go-ahead for the appointment of the chief restructuring officer. You've not negotiated, like, you've appointed the CEO who's only going to start in November, who otherwise could have started far much earlier. That is what political leadership should have dealt with from the beginning, that CEO has been appointed. and then you want to use some consultant's perspective to pump in 10 billion rand. Ultimately, it's like more than that, it will be 15 billion rand with these interventions that you've made now, on the basis of a consultant. Perhaps the CEO and the chief restructuring officer and a stable leadership in SAA could have given a different diagnosis. It's not gospel truth what is said by the consultants. And then Parliament must agree to that. I do not know. If the ANC approves that, then it reflects what happened in the Eastern Cape, the chairs and everything else. That. But I don't think that we should agree to that. I think in the appropriation process, we should use the powers of Parliament to refuse and reject that request for 10 billion before the stability in SAE. I think that this is one issue which non-partisan, no ideological commitments to anything, just on the basis of rationality, must not agree. Must not agree to just pumping 10 billion to SAA before this leadership stability and a believable concrete recovery plan of how is it going to be recovered by people who are going to be implementing that program, because those that are there now are not going to help it. It's a matter of fact, like it has been demonstrated years over years, I think that is what we should do. Even in a study group in the ANC, Tandy must go and deal with it in a much more rational way. Don't compromise or counter in that fashion. Must not agree. Look, must just say no. And then, until there is leadership stability and a believable recovery plan for SAA, then we'll be able to deal with that. This is not difficult. Release to negotiate that the CEO starts, even if it's next week, or I don't know if it's possible to do that. And then appoint the chief restructuring officer, give them a mandate to come with the recovery plan, and then we'll then talk about monies after that. Not to say we must pump in money, like, and we have got new employees who are coming, who have not started the job, like, they do not even know what is the purpose of that being pumped into the whole system. I think that there is no other way to characterize that except to say it's crazy. It's craziness, which must be stopped by a patriotic unity of sensible members of Parliament. Shosho.
DG?
Whatever
it is. Members, it's fine. I thought there was a question that surrounded Section 16 that needed to be responded to adequately. And then members can have another round to relate to this. But fundamental issues has been raised, which I believe must be responded to. Chair, I'm not sure whether it's going to be the DG, because you see how we appropriate and what is termed as to regularize payments, it's going to be an issue that comes in the manner in which they come now for further discussion. But also, before we tie ourselves up, we must also remember the role of the Appropriations Committee in terms of the decision it will take, so that even if we want to expand on the matter and discuss here, we must always remember that there's another committee that will finalize on what will be presented before Parliament by National Treasurer. But it doesn't stop scope to discuss the merits of the allocation of guarantees, given the challenges that has been raised. And I pick up on an interesting matter on whether, as we wait for the medium-term policy budget statement to be presented and having made the interventions that has been made, I think it's fair to allow members to express their opinion, Chair, on how they feel about the allocations that has been made, even when I don't know what flight was. I'm trying very hard here. It's a very difficult scenario. And I'm saying your opinions to be aired, given the fact that eventually we need to look at the legalities of how it was approached. Floyd is pursuing us to make an input now, and which is not possible. And some of these things you need to accept, honorable member. There are certain things that we can do on the spot. There are certain things that we will have to do the necessary consultations. Least we defeat the very same thing that you want us to achieve. So let's allow the responses, and then we and finally at the end, after the legal framework has been tabled, we'll take the decision. And surprisingly, it will suit you, honorable members. Don't rush into things, and don't make the life of the DG so difficult. Let's allow him to respond.
Legal or it's not, right? That's simply it. And let's wait to hear from the lawyers here.
Thanks, Chair. I unfortunately, honorable members, I will just repeat what I said. You know, because for me, it's critical. And if maybe members can hear me out on this one, if there's a call on these guarantees, it then makes it almost impossible not to pay in meeting our obligations as a country, as government, to the lenders. We issued guarantees to this state-owned company, including others. Now, a call on that is I used the word catastrophic earlier. And one had to weigh. Section 16 talk about public interest. I had to weigh that vis-a-vis the public interest and using this and coming to Parliament and knowing very well that it is not an entity, in terms of law, it is not an entity that was not mentioned in the budget speech in February. It is not a DENEL or an SABC, because then it will be illegal. In my limited law legal knowledge, it's specific in terms of what qualifies for an Adjusted Appropriation Act bill to be passed on the 25th. It's very specific. Unforeseeable and unavoidable, etc., including all those announcements made by the minister at the time of the budget. And this falls in that category. So, one, I have the comfort that it is then legal in that giving SAA or SAPO, it could have been SAPO who fell into the same position where they either, you know, were not going to meet their obligations as per the guarantee arrangement that they have, if they have any guarantees. So that's, Chair, for me, the key reason. But however, the legality of which is a different process, as the committee agreed earlier, and it will be dealt with as such. So I wouldn't want to say it in any other way. On Honorable Lisi's question around what I mentioned in terms of regularizing, I'm looking for a better way to regularize. The law is not, it's actually very clear in 16.6. Expenditure in terms of subsection 1 must be included in the next adjustment budget for the financial year in which the expenditure is authorized, or in the other appropriation legislation tabled in the National Assembly within 120 days of the minister authorizing the expenditure, whichever way is sooner. So in that way, that's why I'm using Honorable Tandi, regularizing this context, that it has to come back to the appropriation next adjustment budget, which is coming on the 25th of October, or in the appropriation legislation within 120 days. So insofar as that is concerned, one was regularizing in that context so that we are still within the law. But in terms of now, that's why I said parliamentary process will unfold. How that unfolds will be a parliamentary process. Let's say, Chair, and I'm using a very weird example, if it was war and we had to approve expenditure, military-type expenditure of 100 billion, I can imagine the same thing would have happened in this way. We would have passed money to the appropriate sector, the department. They would have spent the money, and then in the next adjustment budget, as per this, would have been regularized in that way. Because and this is only for emergency. So what we are arguing among ourselves is that we shouldn't lock ourselves into an understanding that suggests that this is normal appropriation. It's not normal appropriation. The normal appropriation would have been through the special appropriation, etc. But it's use of funds in emergency situations, and whether in this way was emergency or not is another thing. And then we can look at it at the time. So I don't know if maybe you...
Further now, can I say you've covered the ground, but I mean to stretch this thing as you are makes you very vulnerable. It's a war situation, not unforeseen and unforeseeable, right? If Lesotho attacks us, who would have thought? But now SAA is a different category of fish. Now, you know what? We've taken this as far. The poor DG, and I use the word not patronizingly, I think you're in a fix, right? And let's agree on a process. Now, Mr. Lees, do you have to speak on this matter? Unless you can help us to how we go forward.
Mr. Chairman, no, it's just another question that hasn't been answered.
We just round up here? Can I ask for advice? Can we do this? Will 48 hours be enough for you to go through your processes of consulting and everything on whether Section 16 has been used correctly here or not? Is it legal what they've done or not? Mr. Frank Jenkins?
Chair, I can deal with it right now, if you want me to.
Because we want their lawyer to be here too.
Fair enough.
Okay? So that we can hear both sides. But if the committee wants to hear, are you ready to actually say whether it's legal? Have you seen their letter? The letter from the DA, it's a 3-page letter, am I right? I'll just browse quickly.
Hey.
Have you responded to all of those issues already?
No.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
No.
There's a letter in your inbox.
Yes, I know.
Which you are mandated now to look at.
Fair enough.
It claims that this thing is illegal. So we said, if it's illegal, it's illegal. All we want from you is an opinion. If it's illegal, say it's illegal, right? Then we have to decide what to do. The second issue that will arise is who does what? Meaning this thing falls... Let me ask you, Frank, for the elucidation of the committee. If this matter is illegal, the question that will arise is the use of the emergency fund or the emergency Section 16 provision. Is that managed by our Committee of Appropriations? Or will we then have to go to the Appropriations Committee and say, this is your matter, this is what we feel, here it is, and you go and address them? Who does it, as a matter of interest? How would it work, in terms of the Moneyballs Act?
In terms of the Moneyballs Act, whether it's in the Adjustments Appropriation Bill or in a Special Appropriation Bill early next year, that will be dealt with by the Appropriations Committee. The Auditor General will issue a statement, an audit report, on all of that. And if the Auditor General finds that that appropriation does not comply with the law, it will be irregular, and that will go to SCOPA. And of course, it can also be referred to other committees for consideration, but it will be referred to SCOPA for a report to the House. So,
different question. I get your drift. That we understand. The question being asked is, when it means taking money from, in terms of Section 16, for an emergency situation, does this committee deal with that or Appropriations Committee deal with that? Because if it's that committee, we can do the work, and then I'll speak to Yvonne Pinky Poser, and they will have to discuss it next week or something, and then you must go and address them and deal with how the issues emerged here. Their letter will have to be sent to your colleague there in the, what's that committee called, Appropriations? Maybe it should never even come to us but gone there, but I can understand why you brought it here because they're appearing today. Just give us guidance. No, it's a legal question. The Money Bills Act. You want to answer that, it's fine. Who does it in terms of the Money Bills Act?
Appropriations go to the Appropriations Committee, Chairman.
Yes, but the use of this emergency fund also falls under
that. That would be, because
that's what I think.
Still an appropriation.
Yeah. Therefore, we can take it so far, and we've got to hand it over to Pinky and her committee. Right. Now, on that matter, what do you want to say, Advocate? No. Okay, fine. In that case, can I suggest, that the committee thinks about this, that we give you the time to look at the DA's letter, which I just browsed through. I looked at the last two paragraphs, actually. And then will Thursday morning, first item on the agenda be okay? They can then arrange for an official. It doesn't have to be you, DG. I think you've got an MTBPS seminar and all that, right? So you're out. But can you send a legal advisor so that we hear the other side? Otherwise, we're going to say it's illegal, then they're going to get senior counsel opinion. If we have to get senior, I think that's what you're suggesting. Is that right in your letter?
Yeah.
Parliamentary lawyer. All right, then we can decide if there's no agreement with them. I think they'll insist that it's legal. Otherwise, I mean,
So then we'll have to go for some independent legal opinion or some arbitration of some sort. Good? So is 48 hours fine?
Yeah.
Right, now what does the committee feel about that? Let him, he hasn't even read your letter. Yeah, fine. So then he wants to reply without having read your letter. So really, is that okay, please? Right, can you send us an official who's not involved in your MTBPS, or forego one of them, and your senior lawyer, yeah? Or an independent senior counsel or something, 10 o'clock on Thursday. Is that doable? Yeah, good. Right. Thursday morning, 10 o'clock. Right, good, thank you. Right, now you had other matters, Mr. Lees. And I'm drawing people's attention to the fact that it's 10 to 5, we still have to discuss the legality of the extension of the SAA board chair's term.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was just the question of the irregular, the waste, fruitless and wasteful expenditure linked to the BRICS Bank. Yeah.
The new development bank. Yes, the bank is in Sandton, the office. Now, in terms of the arrangement and agreement that we have, the bank is pretty new. We agreed that the Africa Regional Center will be in South Africa, and the other countries agreed. Now, in terms of the processes, firstly to get to that decision, and once the decision was taken, it's now where it was an issue, and we agreed on something. After that, when will it be operationalized? Who will staff it? Both ourselves and the bank were in consultation at any given point in time. Now, in terms of this consultation the current year, we then agreed that we will then start leasing a building in Sandton, which we did. Now, in terms of the launching thereof, people could not occupy or could not be there physically before there was an agreement of launching the bank and so on. Now, that launch only happened in this current financial year. The bank is now fully operational. There are staff people. There's people that we've seconded to the bank and other departments that have done the same. The bank is up and running. Now, for that period, before it could be occupied and having gone into the lease, that's when the audit process was taking place. And with a very responsible auditor general, they even physically went there to check. And obviously the security was there with no one inside. That's understood, and then they had to do it. And that's why then they regarded this as fruitless. But I can comfortably and confidently say now the bank is operational. The lease is going to be taken over by the BRICS Bank, NDB. Actually, they have taken it over because that was the understanding. So this it's not going to come onto our books. It will obviously be a bill to the new development bank and not only us. It was an interim period when we are still establishing this office. And in terms of the second question around the staff in the ministry, Chair, maybe let me appeal to the committee to request that we have a parliamentary question to this effect, and that question will be answered in detail. And the question came from the from EFF. Yes.
But what is difficult with answering a simple question like saying how many staff members you've employed, DG? Like, I mean, it's a simple question.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's
an empirical question.
And how many have you employed thus far?
Can I have Derek Honeycomb?
Yeah, well, a very quick one. The question.
Yeah, that's right.
And the minister wasn't able to answer it immediately. And he said he
did to us, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that was, how long ago was that?
Yeah.
2 weeks ago?
I think the committee secretary is
difficult.
Can you follow up on these things?
For the minister to find out how many advisors he has.
Yeah, it's straightforward empirical matter. No, we agree, Derek.
Yeah.
It's fine. Right. My brother, please, it's an empirical question.
No.
Chair, you're paying their salary.
No, I know. I mean, I
if he doesn't know, he can say he doesn't know, like. And then we'll then begin to.
Is it 700 or is it 5,000 or is it 20 or what?
You can say you don't know.
No. Chair, I have a list here. I have a list, and my colleague, because he's directly responsible, is showing it to me. But all I'm saying is that I would be more comfortable, Chair, to verify what's here, put the names next to each level, and it's for. And then
I can say 20. It might be 22. I can
about
say
how many names have you got there? Let's simplify it. About how many names?
I've got about 20 names.
About 20 names. Thank you. Right.
How many is permitted in terms of the ministerial process?
It's handbook, not process. Handbook, yeah. You mean handbook.
Yeah, yeah, but it's a guideline, Chair.
Yeah, it's a guideline. And you can apply for the minister, and the minister can exempt you. Joan, if you can chair this meeting and get people to behave, we can finish earlier, Joan. Welcome, Joan.
Yes,
we'd like to finish, but, you know, this committee is unruly here. Right, fine. Right.
But
so, basically, you're right. The question is...
Yeah. Do you know the way government is designed was to say that ministry performs certain functions and the department performs certain functions, right? And we must not take it as a simple mechanical issue when a minister is trying to build a department in his office and employ all sorts of characters there to replicate departmental functions. Or even do the things which otherwise are supposed to be done at a departmental level. So it's not a shallow question that it's about, like, we need to be told in proper detail. This letter was written a long time ago. I think it's a lot of days now. It's more than 20 days now. To say, how many people do you have? What does the deadline say? What is their responsibilities? Why do you have to constitute a rally to run a ministry when other ministers are not running that fashion? Like, that is a principal issue that must be responded to. That you're not trying to create a parallel department when there is one existing. Like, if the minister is confident of his politics, he must persuade the department to follow his politics, and not try to replicate a parallel department on top of one that is existing, because it's wasteful. And it's irresponsible for a national treasury, which is supposed to take care of our resources, to manage our resources in such a reckless way.
Okay, can I raise something, right? There is a question to the House. When is it likely to be, not next week, Wednesday, the earliest? When do you know which date it's meant to be presented orally in the House? Do you have any idea? Does anybody know? This will be the economic cluster, right? Who? Samuel, when will he be in the House?
On the 22nd of November.
Ooh, that's very far away. All right, let me put this to you. There is a question in the House. What we could do is the minister is going to appear here in 3 weeks' time when he brings the MTBPS. The question can be raised there. Or alternatively, if people want to put a written question via the committee, maybe we can arrange that. So can people send me a draft? And I will forward it to the minister. He must reply within 7 days or something. That's what I'm suggesting, right? So can we then refer to what Floyd said? And I think I know he's right. Actually, it's what we'd like. I think from now on, when we have the annual report, just like when you have the budget, the minister or the deputy must appear, preferably the minister, because he's the ultimate accounting head, right? That's what committees are doing. In any case, where they can. But, you know, with the MTBPS process and so on, and I know it's a new minister and deputy minister, no matter what people think, it's a big task to suddenly become Minister of Finance. You can be in the system for 30 years even. The truth is, it's very challenging. It's his first one in a very difficult circumstance, and the deputy. So I think it's correct. In future, can we agree that the minister or deputy should be here when the annual report is presented? Derek, yes?
Yes, I agree on that. But I do express my dissatisfaction, although I don't disagree with your proposal with respect to the question that has been put to the parliamentary question that has been put to the minister. But I'm going to express my dissatisfaction that the question was also asked here, prior to the question being tabled in written form. And the minister said he will just have to check and he'll come back to us. And he hasn't. And it's not a difficult thing for the minister to come back to us on. And that would include special advisers. There's ministerial staff and there's special advisers. So I'm repeating the question, and I don't think the minister needs to wait 3 weeks to answer a very simple question.
Okay, Derek, I think we agree with Derek. Can we just go ahead? Can you reply? What's today? What's a Tuesday? What's the problem? Friday noon, can you give the reply? Number of people, what they're doing there, number of advisors, what the Minister of Handbook says, And has exemption been sought by the Minister of Public Service and Administration? And has that exemption been given? Okay? We don't need to have any more questions, right? Good.
And then the approval by the Minister of Public Service and Administration must not be big dated. It's possible.
No, I'm not going to do all of that, really. He can say that his view. Does the committee agree with Floyd? No. Right. Let's move on. Mr. Lees?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we've paid a huge amount, billions of rands to the BRICS Bank, and I'm just astounded that we're actually picking up the rent tab for them, even if it is for a short period. I don't know why. Why are we paying it? It might have been some form of agreement reached behind closed doors somewhere. But, I mean, we funded this thing, and yeah, we're paying their rent for them as well. So I'm afraid I'm right on the side of the Auditor General on that being wasteful. But Mr. Chairman, I've just received a WhatsApp picture here. It's advertising a Matlosana Council, Matlosana, it's Clarksdorp, that area, municipality, investment conference. And guess what? It's being sponsored by a bankrupt SAA. It's just fortuitous. I don't know if someone's watching on TV and has just sent it to me. No, probably not. But the fact is that it's astounding, Mr. Chairman. Here we're talking about the use of Section 16 to give this company money. And here they are sponsoring an investment conference. And as important as investment obviously is, no one can decry that, but when you're bankrupt, you don't do it.
Most profound thing. Oh, Yara. What else do you say? It's surrealistic, Dondo. I mean, really, surrealistic. Which is SAA. Somebody used the word craziness, but he was saying something else. I'm talking not about the department. I'm talking about SA. Surrealism is the only definition. Now, look, on that matter, can we get more information? Right, you are the shareholder there. Can you, within 48 hours, by Friday noon, give us a written... Now, Thabo, you're in charge here, right? He's got a lot on his plate. So you have to ensure... You see, I can't... the committee is now instructing you, Thabo, not me, because nobody listens to me, that you ensure that if they haven't replied to you by noon, that you write to them and say, please, we want the reply on that matter of that municipality, formerly known as Clarksdorp, and the issue of the minister's staff. Are we agreed? Good. It's an instruction. Put it down there, please. Because then I have to follow up on Saturday morning and so on. Right. Now, let me ask members. Okay, it's running out of time, right? So, okay, I'll drop my question related to what he had asked, but not SAA, the previous one. Okay, is there anything else people want to pursue right now in the, say, 15 minutes left on the matters that have been discussed about the annual report? Now, I know Tandy had put a question to the AG's office. They are here, right? Solly and team, are they here? Sorry, Solly left. Oh, because I thought he can come in. All right, fine. Doesn't matter, Tandy. Right, Floyd.
No, just I'm not sure if I heard what was the response on the assurance that we asked on the AGM of the 3rd of November. What was the response there for SAA?
I was going to come to the tie-up because it's linked also to our resolution, which said that they must meet by the end of the year. So we're going to look at that, and it's not feasible is what's emerging. It's not feasible. Did you, will you agree? Yeah, it's not feasible. Right. So... You see, the problem, DG, that does worry one, you know. You're a new DG and we're sympathetic. Well, at least some of us are. And it's not an easy DG to be. But obviously, when you propose the date of the 3rd, you must have thought about the parliamentary process. So it's befuddling that you thought somehow with an appropriations bill, and now we discover the president in December facing an ANC conference is going to leave all of those issues and then say, okay, let me sign this thing quickly. Oh, maybe he will. Actually, on this matter, but the point is, you know, the point is, it's not doable 3rd of November, so it worries us, really, that the very committee, I mean, the very department that should know the Money Bills Act in and out, proposes a date that's unrealistic, except that I know what you're going to answer, what he says, Mr. Lees,
that you don't necessarily have to have the appropriations bill passed through to have the AGM. That he says you can have the AGM without a going concern, which is something I want to raise in the last item. Because if that's doable, this committee might decide, hey, we don't care, we want this AGM held this year, which is something that you might decide. But that matter is on the agenda for a moment, because you have to look at it holistically based on Mr. Lease's legal opinion, and then the policy issues will be decided by us, not Mr. Lease. Mr. Lease, you won't decide, you'll provide a framework. So, sorry? Yeah. Now, Mr. Lee, so basically, I don't know how you decide the date. You make yourself very vulnerable. It reinforces the perceptions people in the ANC have, let alone out there, that, you know what, Ms. Minyani is going to be there till 2019, right? And that is something the ANC must take a decision on. Right, and other parties have already taken a decision. Yes, Mr. Jenkins.
Chair, I just want to ask a question. If Section 16 says that the minister may defray expenditure and for the use of funds, which means it's an action, and only later do we call it sort of regularized. It's not really regularizing it because it was in terms of the law. But you have to then put it in a special appropriation or in an adjustments appropriation. But nevertheless, it's already been defrayed for the use. So it can be used. It's in their account. So the going concern can be flashing. It can go from green from red to green. Why can't you have the AGM then before this president signs those two pieces of legislation? Just a question.
Chair, I'm reminding you when I reminded you to understand the word regularize, you see. It was a coded message, DG, to the chair, you see. When I'm not going to quote from the PFMA, I'm going to give you my understanding whilst I was still a SCOPA member. You see, you can spend money, but you need to regularize it by putting it in the books for later approval. It doesn't mean at that time you are asking for approval. You are just making it to adhere to, you know. That's why I wanted you to put this word in your head, regularize, you see. Now, maybe you should make a suggestion or a request that if it's possible, because, you see, it's not SAA that's going to decide when its AGM should be when it's under administration in a way. I'm using that word very carefully, under administration. Because, you see, any organization that goes with a begging hand to ask money, equally can't govern itself. It doesn't have that capacity to decide. So I want to make a suggestion for DG to reconsider bringing the AGM a little bit forward so that we deal with it, it goes to the NCOP, and probably it gets the ascension. Floyd is very ambitious, says next week it's the DG to decide and so on. Because you can't say you are waiting for the MTVPS. You will just be regularizing a decision that has already been implemented. Chair?
Everybody's disputing what you're saying.
Yeah,
fine.
Okay.
So can we now, is there any other issue now that people want to raise about the annual report? No, I've had quite...
No, Chair. It means, therefore, the SAA and the SARS will be discussed when? When they come for their quarterly meeting?
You see, the SARS. There's a date set in your program, the draft program, which you're going to look at tomorrow, right? It's, I think, the 28th. Am I right, Alan? 28th of November. I spoke to Commissioner Moyani yesterday and made that clear to him, that even if it's not regularized by the minister and the speaker's process, we want the draft report or something, but we can't leave it till next year. On SAA, there's the 29th, I think, they appear for the next quarterly report, November. That's the last week of the parliamentary term, because the following week we're not sitting. It's a committee week, and we've agreed we're not going to sit that week because of the circumstances of what's going on in the country. So now, if there's nothing else, can we then move on to the last item on the agenda, which is the legal opinion that ELF was asked to do, having received from the minister the documentation. We've got four documents in all, right?
Now, we also indicate there on 16 September, Mr. Lees, of his own volition, wrote to the CIPRC and then suggested that they send us a copy of the letter by the CIPRC to the minister, and if need be, they can send it via the committee chair, because he would have anyway referred it to the committee. What I was very surprised about, it doesn't sound like normative, is that the letter was released to us, yet I had asked the minister for it at the outset. When we got the documentation, you know, you'll remember our own exchange, I was actually pushing. They had asked for an extension for a day till 5 p.m., I think, the next day. They emailed it to me at 4:57, is that adequate sort of stuff? So I said, no, we need other documentation. And then I've been exchanging with Samuel, to be fair, and the minister, and they agree. It's just that we were all busy with our own things, and we got it, I think, on Thursday. Is that right, Samuel? So all four documents that they can give us are before us. So I asked the legal unit to deal with the two questions. One is whether the Minister of Finance provided the necessary documentation in terms of the resolution that we adopted, and secondly, whether the extension of the term is legally tenable. I've had a private exchange with the Deputy Minister in another forum, and he indicated to me, he's trying to hide, that he, you remember, he missed his flight and all that, and in the rush he consulted with a lawyer, and it's human also, he referred to the wrong section of the MOI, which most of us felt, we didn't have to be lawyers in that case. There are times when you can say it's not legal, and the lawyer was right to say it's not legal. But now they're arguing it in terms of another section, and they're arguing about the nine-month term, and that I leave to you. But on the background and process, are there any questions? Is that fine? We are going to meet and settle our issues, right, outside this meeting. But then can you deal with the section? I think just take us quickly through regulatory framework and why you came to the conclusion you did under legality of extension and conclusion, right? About 10 minutes, no more. 10 past.
Yes.
No. Even 5 if you can do it.
Thank you, Chairperson. The regulatory framework, when we started the Companies Act, Chairperson, really leaves the term of office of a director to the memorandum of incorporation. In addition to that, we have the King Reports on Good Governance, which really requires that we have non-executive directors. And I could have elaborated more in the opinion on that, but to have a board that makes independent decisions to run a country to the benefit of, to run the company, to the benefit of the shareholder and not to the benefit of the employees of the company as such, although they also play a role in the new thinking about the shareholder and so on. But it's still fundamentally about the shareholder's interests. You need an independent board. So it's very important that you have a majority of non-executive members on the board. And that's a sort of a premise that underpins the whole opinion. So when I looked at both the opinion of the CIPC, the Companies and Intellectual Properties Commission, who refers to A section 7.1 that says once your term as a director has expired, you cannot hold office. I compare that to what the minister in his letter indicated, referring to 13.4.2 of the 4.6, I think. 13.4.2, read with clause 13.4.6. I put that in paragraph 16 of my opinion on page 3. We have to look at that. Why do we have to look at that? Because that is what is the normal way of interpreting both legislation and contracts and any legal document. And I refer to a court case there that set out how we do interpretation of these documents. And it's basically you have to read things in context, you have to look at the purpose, and of course we have to pay attention to the language that is used. But you can't elevate the one above the other. So looking at it in context, we can't read 13.7.1 on its own. 13.7.1 says once your term of office have expired, you're out of office. So does that happen immediately, or is there something else in the memorandum of understanding that deals with it, keeping in mind what the King Committee on Good Governance has said? And my conclusion on that is that obviously we want to get to an AGM where the directors must account to the shareholder and where we will then appoint new shareholders. That appointment might take longer than 1 or 2 days. And one can imagine a nomination of a director. Director might be somewhere
outside the country and might only accept that nomination 2 or 3 days later. So what the MOI says is that you actually vacate your office once the process of appointing a new director has completed, which should happen at the AGM. If it doesn't happen at that AGM where we've envisaged it, it's 6 months after that date where we where it should have happened. So that is the point where the director vacates the office. Well, it could be 6 months, Honorable Tobias. It could be. But it should be at the AGM. The AGM is that critical moment that in terms of the Companies Act, we want to resolve these issues. So one should come to an AGM prepared. So my view, Chair, is that the opinion of the CIPC, for lack of a better word, is incomplete. They should have looked at the other parts of the MOI as well, which then says we want to finalize this term of office of the director. And if we can't have that, the MOI in any case make provision that there will be a time when your directorship expires, although you couldn't actually account at an AGM. So given what was said in the committee, and I've tried to put as much as I can in the opinion, by operation of law, the chairperson as a non-executive director should stay in office until that AGM or 6 months after it expired. Now, that date should be determined from what I've read from the end of August, because in the statement when she was appointed and when the explanation was given to the committee, it was said that we thought the AGM will happen at the end of August, let's say 31 August. So 6 months from 31 August, there can be no non-executive chairperson as she is at the moment, but hopefully the AGM will come before that time, and the process of completing a new appointment of a new non-executive director as chairperson will take place. And it's at that point, in terms of the law, that it will expire. So my view is that the Minister of Finance did not even have to extend the term. He could have just said, in terms of the MOI, you will remain director, and of course you can resign as director. No one can force you to do it. And certainly from that, there was no need to set out that notice that they referred to in Section 70, subsection 6 of the Companies Act, that you have to notify because there's a new director appointed or a director has ceased to be in office. That might be an issue of interpretation, because her office ceased, but she's not out of office. So I would think that notice must be sent after the AGM when the completion of the new chairperson has been done. And that, in short, is the opinion, chairperson. So I don't find it legally untenable, or I find it legally tenable, that the non-executive chairperson, as she is at the moment, will stay in office for that period I've indicated. And, Chair, from what I've heard in the committee, it might not be the most popular opinion, but that's my legal opinion. Exactly.
All right. Now, on the legal opinion, questions, please, Mr. Leith. Fine. And you want to speak? Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm not a lawyer either, and so I have to listen to what is being said, and that is where I leave it. But, Mr. Chairman, the question here really has now very much becoming, the discussion is about Ms. Nyeni as chair of the board. And that ceasing. What I'm not hearing is her directorship ceasing. And so it sounds like to me that this is just about being chair of the board, not being removed as a director of the board. And I hope, DG, you can reassure me that that's not the case. And that's reinforced, Mr. Chairman, because at 20 past 6 or thereabouts on Thursday evening, Ms. Nyeni was being interviewed on Gagazi Radio, largely in Zulu, but I can understand Zulu, as you know. I was tipped off, just as I was tipped off about this other thing. What Ms. Nyeni stated when asked by a listener about her term of office was that her term of office will end in September 2018. Not 2017, not 2019, 2018. And that kind of, I didn't understand what, and she was very emphatic about that. No one was going to kick her out. Her term of office was 2018. And so that's why I'm now concerned that this, even if the AGM's on the 3rd of November, Mr. Mnyeni will continue on the board, maybe not as chair, but as a director. And I wonder if the DG could clarify that.
No, Chair, like, you know, I earlier said that, you know, this thing of relying on lawyers, and it's very problematic because this section that is relying on now was read in that meeting when he gave us a wrong legal opinion. It was mentioned, like, now, you only saw it now, and we gave him even, I think, 48 hours to go and look at it and come back, and then he came with the wrong legal opinion. And then later on, when he sees another legal opinion from a different lawyer, he changes his mind and wants to advise us. And then we must consistently rely on such a lawyer. I think it's extremely responsible. Like, I think
I'm calling that out, really. You cannot insult somebody's integrity. It's not just you. It's an entire legal unit. And it's not true that he was given 48 hours. He was given a few hours,
you
know, and he came back the same day.
Chairperson, I'm a chief whip of the EFF. I'm going to write a submission on why this lawyer must not be a lawyer of parliament in the first place. Like, he does this every time. It's not the first time. Like, yes, it makes extremely stupid legal mistakes which have to be dealt with and must be exposed like that. And we must not accept that. We must deal with it in that fashion. Right? That is the whole situation.
I don't know why you allow Floyd to say Advocate Jenkins made stupid.
Can you speak up?
Floyd must withdraw there.
It's allowed.
No, Floyd. No, please.
Like
let,
that. There's no evidence.
You can
what
disagree
said.
With
yes.
the legal advice, but to call it stupid and to use the word
is being political. That's outrageous, actually.
Yes.
And your whole unit is being condemned, actually.
No, please.
Because
Floyd.
Don't you go through your whole unit?
No.
That's what you told me, Jenkins, right?
No.
Your whole unit agrees with it. Right.
Even if it was him alone, Chair, to call it stupid.
Yeah, it's wrong.
I want us to be clean in how we engage.
Yeah.
And that's the part I really cannot understand why Floyd... Floyd. You know, we can
but
agree
no,
to
there's
disagree.
No basis in the rules of the National Assembly that proscribes me.
You can't call somebody stupid and then you say there's no
but
rule.
But in the rules of the National Assembly, you can...
I can try to check it in the rules. It's just that it's late in the
go
evening.
Check that.
I've got the rules here with me now.
What's it?
It's
wrong.
It's unbecoming language.
That's right. In this context,
no.
Yeah. It doesn't matter whether it's
and
wrong
and
or
he
not.
Even, he's
yeah.
sitting here.
And he works damn hard and he works as part of a team.
You know, Chairperson, I'll never apologize for that. Like, you must know that. That is, it's a matter of fact that he addresses nonsense. Like, and we must not mislead a parliamentary committee that is given a responsibility to oversee the National Treasurer to be every time. It doesn't happen in any other committee of parliament where a lawyer sits on a permanent basis in a committee. Every now and then, what is your legal opinion? What is your legal opinion? And then even when we wanted to give him for 8 hours, he says, I can speak now, because he thinks a member of committee of parliament. It's inappropriate and it's decidedly wrong. And we can't tiptoe around that when we condemn wrong practice and wrong culture which you have developed and you've accommodated here. It's wrong, it must be discontinued. If there's a legal dispute issue, we must write, you must not even come to the committee like our other lawyers don't come to the committees. We'll write the legal department and then the legal department gives an official legal advice signed off by the head of the department. Not that we must be babysitted by a lawyer who gives us contradictory information. All this information, I actually saw this, I gave a political argument on why Dudumyeni had to go. Even when this was brought to attention, we still, but you, as a lawyer, he said, no, that is the law. And then we take a resolution of parliament, which says that this is illegal, and well, National Treasurer defied in terms of how we had given guidance on it. The chairperson of the committee even was on television was on television repeating what was misguided by a lawyer. And then we must keep quiet about that. So those are some of the things that have to be dealt with decisively, that that lawyer must not come to our committee meetings. We will write to him if we think this legal advice that we need on a specific issue. Not that every time we'll be told, yeah, right on this. Not just now, you say to him, on the issue which we're discussing, just now, can we give you 48 hours? No, I want to speak now. No. And then that is what we must be subjected to. We must protect the integrity of this committee. We must protect the integrity of Parliament.
My point of order is that he's made the point repeatedly. We've heard what he's saying. We completely disagree with him. He's a lone voice in this matter. I think we should proceed.
His opinion, you disagree with it. You can get your own opinion and comments now on the process.
I want to write a formal submission to the chairperson of chairs and to the speaker about the consistent interference of lawyers of parliament in a committee window. It is not standard. It is not prescribed. No, it's not allowed by any rules of parliament to do that.
No, it's a legal matter, and we have to use parliament to legal units. We can't
Legal opinion by all committees of parliament is sought properly. You sit as a committee and agree that on this issue we do not agree.
Right, we've covered it. We don't agree with.
So we'll deal with the separate
process. Now, what is the
on way forward?
Yeah,
on way forward. The National Treasury knows better than we do that the crisis in SAA is because of the chairperson, and DG, to protect the integrity as a person as well, you should make an intervention that says that there must be an AGM as soon as possible. I think that is the principal position that we should take. Like, you do not need any other justification that we need an AGM for the current chair's term to come to an end, and then a new leadership is given a responsibility to run the airline. It's even better because on the 1st of November, the new CEO of SAA will be starting. It must not be received by a chair who has been part of a crisis there. He must start on a clean slate and then would then get to revive SAA. And one other thing that you're not realizing, DG, is that this issue which you are saying is the reason why you went for Section 16 can easily become reality by insisting that Dudumini remains chairperson of SAA. Because all these other lenders can say that we are calling our monies. Now, like, if that is going to be there until next year or 2019, they will just say that, but what is the purpose of retaining our monies in the as loans to SAA, let's recall them, and then it becomes what? Is it the 15 billion? Then where are we going to get 15 billion? We're going to invade the Section 16 again. Then it's all hell breaks loose. Like, so whichever way.
Just on a procedure, can I just draw the attention of the committee? It is now 17:27. We've got 3 minutes left. Others of us have to go to a meeting. So I'm giving an extra five minutes at most. To members, Tandy still got to speak. But I'm leaving for my other meeting, and I think the ANC comrades have to leave too. We can continue tomorrow morning if you want to.